So the journey was one of those kinds of journeys, you know, timeless and spaceless and all. And we did Iran and Afghanistan, and then David did Pakistan, and then Kashmir, and we went on a safari by horseback up to a very holy cave in Kashmir, Amarnath Cave. And that was beautiful and delightful, and we had two lovely girls with us. And we met holy men along the way, and we shared hashish with them, and they shared theirs with us, and we all learned how to smoke chillums. But to me, it was just like a big stone hole. You know, I mean, it might have been a holy cave, but it wasn't doing it to me. And after you've been on horseback for 3 days, and you can hardly move from pain, and you've come across snow caps and, you know, and slept with the ice and snow beating by you, and you finally get to this place, there is such an emotional intensity about wanting to find what you're looking for. And, you know, it was lovely, and we all said, isn't this great, isn't this wonderful? But in my heart, it was just another, you know, another strike. Now, in the course of that Land Rover trip, we did learn a great, great deal. We met many pundits, and our guide in India was an extraordinarily beautiful person, Harish Johari, who was a very dear friend of Shyam's. And Harish is a sculptor and a very high being. He's a very, very beautiful person. And Harish and David and I traveled through great parts of India looking, and I had a bottle of LSD and STP and other things, and I was turning on holy men. I mean, if I was making an exchange, they, you know, I didn't want to just take, and I wanted to give them things that I also figured maybe they'll tell me what LSD is, you know? And so a Tibetan Lama would take it, and he'd say, very interesting. Anything else? No. Another guy would take it and say, got a terrible headache. An old Theravadan monk. A Swami takes it and says, it's just like meditation. Some young lamas take it and say, wow, that's the greatest, you know. Some sadhus take it and take DMT and, can we get some more? You know, they sound just like Americans. And I was becoming like the holy man of, there was some inversion going on that was very strange. That wasn't what I had gone to India about. It was a side matter. And we met many pundits, many wise men, and they told us many things, but they always were talking in the second person. It was always like, and this happened to him. They tell you about Ramakrishna or Ramana Maharshi or somebody else, right? Well, I can read books that are written by somebody who's telling me about somebody else. You know, I mean, that's the whole American trip. Well, that trip went on for 4 months, 3.5 months. And we finally ended up in Kathmandu, Nepal, and I was very, very depressed. I don't know whether it was the hashish. It might have been. Or it was the despair that I had done this final thing that I knew how to do, and nothing had happened. I had hit nothing, you know, blank. And we were about to go off to Japan. We were going to leave the rover with Harish and go off to Japan to meet with Alan Watts and Gary Snyder and have a nice, you know, seminar in Kyoto, and then come back to the United States. And I looked ahead, and what was I going to do? Come back to the United States and talk about LSD again? No. I mean, I didn't know any more than before I went to India. Everybody would come back and say, well, what happened in India? And it was very discouraging. And so I was sitting, being discouraged, in the Blue Tibetan, which is a hippie restaurant in Kathmandu. Giving away LSD to French hippies. And it's a little side story, but it's relevant later. A lama, a young Tibetan lama, came in, and he had a mala for sale. And the Tibetans are in very, very bad way in India. They are extremely hard up. The Indians are very embarrassed about the thing. There are thousands of them coming over, and the Indians won't publicly say how many because it's politically uncool in their relations with the Chinese. And they're putting them all in these terrible camps where the life is so horrible, and they're all moving them to the plains where they're all dying of TB, and it's ugly. And the Tibetans are such beautiful people, you just can't believe it. Just so extraordinarily beautiful. Great calm, great. So he came in selling a mala, not this, a mala, and so I said, how much did he want for it? It was his mala, you could tell, and when a lama gets to selling his mala, you know he's pretty hard up, you know. He said, whatever I wanted to pay, so I said I wanted to pay 30 rupees, which was $4 and a little over. And he said, no, that was too much, he only wanted 15 rupees. I said, no, I insisted on paying 30 rupees. So I got it for 30 rupees, and I was happy, and he was happy, and right. So it felt like a good mala to have, although everybody said, you can't buy a mala. Right? It comes from your teacher, you don't buy malas. Sitting in the Tibetan restaurant that same day, and that story has another part later on, sitting in the restaurant that same day, while I'm there, in walks a guy, an American. He's 6'7". He is got a long beard and long hair, and he's wearing a white cloth, barefooted, mala. Now, all the hippies are dressed in very far-out Indian holy men costumes because that's the trip in India, right? Nepal. But this guy, immediately, he walked over to our table and sat down, and I sensed something very special about this guy. The best way I can characterize what I sensed was almost within a minute, I realized that while everybody else I had always met was looking, he knew. It was as if he was at the place. There was a different feeling about him. It was not like he was searching any longer. There was a different kind of a feeling. Well, this was the closest thing I had come to what I was looking for, and how absurd to go 6,000 miles to meet a 23-year-old Californian from Laguna Beach, you know. I mean, how completely outrageous, you know. Well, David and I took him back to our hotel and snuck him in through the corridors of this very fancy. We were going first class since David was quite wealthy. And we were at the Stowalti Hotel, which is a 5-star hotel, and they don't let barefoot sadhus in the lobby because they make their employees wear shoes, and why shouldn't the guests wear shoes? You know? However, we snuck him up in the elevator up to our room, and the four of us, Harish and David and this fellow and I, had about a 4-day seminar on peach melbas, and tea and the last of the hashish and LSD and the Tibetan books and various Indian books and philosophy and religion and on and on and on it went. And the room was quite extraordinary. It was a beautiful seminar, I mean, a very intense seminar. This fellow knew a lot. He was an initiate clearly in, he was an initiate of the Kajipas, a lama, a Tibetan sect. And he was an initiate in a Shaivite and initiate in a Vaishnavite sects of Hinduism. And he knew of whence he spoke. He had left the United States when he finished high school, right? And was a wise man. Wise man. Well, when the time came for us to go to Japan, I didn't want to go because here was a guy who knew something, and I decided I wanted to stay with him, but I was giving up traveling first class and all of the luxuries of that for his life, which was quite a radical departure from anything I'd ever lived before. So I left Kathmandu and left David and Harish, and off I went with this fellow. Now, no Land Rover, camper, no nice hotels, no Americanized restaurant, westernized restaurants, no bottled water, no canned goods, no suitcase full of oreomycin and entroviiform and on and on, no toilet paper. All right, and what I had left, he then gave away. So that very shortly thereafter, we were walking out of Calcutta. I was barefoot in a cloth with a blanket, a shoulder bag, and a Tibetan drum I had bought. He had an ektara, a one-stringed instrument, and a shoulder bag, and barefoot in a cloth and a blanket. And there we were. And any extra money I had, he gave away, and there off we went. And we were eating from vendors in the streets or at various temples along the way, and we went on a pilgrimage from temple to temple. But it was interesting, because what he was doing all the time was he was training me. Now, I don't know how, you know, I'm used to, you'll sign up, you'll register on registration day, and the course will have 40 weeks, and then there will be final exams, and so on. And to say that he was training me is absurd. I mean, when you're walking along the street or lying by the side of the road, for him to, like I'd say, gee, I feel really sick. He'd say, feelings are like waves. He said, in the calm ocean, just watch the waves recede. Sickness feeling, watch it go into the distance. Or I'd say, what's going to happen in the future? Do you think I'm going to get, when will I go back to the United States? He'd say, don't worry about the future. If you live now, when the future comes, you will be more conscious, you will have more power, and whatever decision you make then will be better than any decision you could make now. Just live now. When I'd say, let me tell you about this great drug experience I had in the past, he'd say, words are like birds, they're like clouds passing in the sky. He said, just calm your mind, you know, forget about the past.
WBAI, New York.
Well, he was taking my whole game away from me, you know. My past, my... I was told, you know, in my family, you plan for the future. And as far as the past, that was my stock in trade, as you've seen today. I just doing my things. And he was teaching me. He was teaching me, like, how to do mantra. I said to him, gee, I've got this beautiful mala, and I wore it, you know, like beads. And he took it off from my neck, and he held it, and he... Aum mani padme hum, aum mani padme hum, aum mani padme hum. Bid me hung out, money, bid me hung out, money, bid me hung out, money, bid me hung. And on and on and on. The word of it all, of the formless all, Mane, the jewel, Padme, the unfolding lotus, Hung, the realization in form, or Aum, the formless, Hung, the heart, or Padme, the opening senses. So it's Aum, the unformed, is like a jewel in the center of the unfolding lotus, and it resides in your heart. Om Mane Padme Hum. And the hung has got to be pronounced with the nose closed. And it's got to resonate in the middle of the heart, in what's called the heart cave, in the hridayam, which is right here, not over here. It's a little to the right of the sternum. And it's hung, hung, om, and om, om, spelt in the, in English, O-M, is pronounced as if it were spelled A-U-M, and it starts, it's all the sounds of the universe, and it starts at the back of the mouth and moves forward to the front. So it's om, 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 om mani padme hum. That's the Tibetan translation. And he gave that to me, and he did that for a number of hours with me. And then he took, gave me the mala, and he took the mala, and we did it together for hours. Now, this is not for minutes, for hours. And then he left me, and I kept doing it. And then it came nighttime, and I got into bed, and I lay down, and I closed my eyes, and suddenly I heard like a chorus of thousands and thousands of these deep, deep voices. Om mani padme hum, om mani padme hum. And it was as if I was hearing voices over time. I mean, it's what's called the Omkar, or the universal sound of Om. I had tuned in on the sound of the universe, and this was my vehicle to do it. I had done that, and I had tuned in on this place where that sound is. And it was a very real sound for me. And what I realized after a while with this fellow was that the mantra was always going on in him. For example, now that I've been working very hard all year, all the time I'm talking to you, this is very hard for you to appreciate because I can't do two things at once. But Om Mani Padme Hum, or Om Mani Padme Hum, Om Mani, is going on inside of me. And when I stop for a moment, I just go back into that, and then I come out again. And it's a place in the center, and I'll tell you more about that in a minute. So he's training me what I can eat. Like I say, gee, I'd love some scrambled eggs. No eggs. You know, the thing that bothers me about India is you can't get a good steak. No steak. Gee, I'm hungry. Well, you already had a meal today. Just slowly, I mean, subtle little things he was training me on. And you'd go to a rest house, and there would be a wooden table without this nice soft carpet, and that would be the place you'd sleep. And so after a few weeks of this, my feet were covered with blisters, my hip bones were all black and blue, my stomach, I get this terrible dysentery, see, and our first aid kit was a package of Band-Aids and a tube of Johnson first aid cream. And I get this terrible dysentery, and I'd say, oh, if I only had enteroviform, he'd say, just fast for a few days, you've got to develop the bacteria to be able to handle it. Don't worry about it, you know. And in the presence of him, what could I do? I mean, you know, if I was hungry, here was a guy 6'7" who was eating less than I was eating. Right? And healthy and vital and a beautiful musician, a master musician, master musician. And he'd walk down the, well, we would walk down the street, of course, and we were in the name of the game, we were holy men, we were sadhus. In India. Well, now around cities in India, sadhus is getting to be a dirty word because it upsets the economy to have 10 million hippies hanging around, 10 million dropouts hanging around in India, not earning their keep. In the villages, they are still treated with much reverence, and you'd walk through a village and people would rush out to touch your feet. And that, of course, freaked me completely because I was just a Westerner on, you know, who happened to be dressed, you know, going barefoot, but I didn't, you know. Once we stopped at Baneshwar at these Buddhist caves to meditate, And I found a little cave, and I went in, and I sat down, and I got very calm, and I closed my eyes, and I went into a reverie, I'd say, for maybe 15 to 20 minutes. And I woke up, and I looked ahead of me, and by the door, it was very dark in the cave, there was a little pile. I thought there were pebbles. Maybe I had stepped over because I wasn't dark adapted when I walked. Looked closer, and they were coins. Some pilgrims had come along, and they'd seen this holy man meditating, and because in India, the grusta, the householder, part of his spiritual responsibility is to provide for the holy man. You know, I was finding that it paid to be a holy man, that it was like... I quickly gave the money away, you know. It was upsetting me because I wasn't who they thought I was. But he told me, he said, look, he said, when somebody blesses you, and you can't bend over and touch them because it's inappropriate for Sadhu to do that, to touch their feet, but you can do it in your heart to them. And they're getting the blessing from doing that. That's a spiritual act from them. And you can complete the energy cycle by doing it in your heart back to them. So you bless everybody that blesses you. So it's all right. He has to get an annual, he's a resident, he's got a resident visa. So he said to me, we will have to go and see my guru. This was the first time he had ever mentioned having a guru. And he says, I think what we ought to do is go to Harish and borrow the Land Rover to go up into the mountains because it'll save time and we only have a few days till the visa expires. Well, the Land Rover is a $6,500 car, and in India it's probably the most valuable car in India because you hardly see cars. They're all taxis. Most of them, very few people have private cars outside of the main cities. And this was a possession which I didn't want. I mean, I had finished with possessions. I was very happy now with my shoulder bag. I didn't want all this possession. However, he wanted it. And so, okay, we'll go in the Rover, although it was bugging me to do that. And I knew that Harish really didn't want to give it to us. He was enjoying it too much. Because, you know, he was enjoying having this car. But we went, I said, Harish isn't going to give it to us, and Bhagavan Das said, he'll give it to us. We went, and an hour later, we had the car, and we were on our way. But I was bugged, and I was sort of irritated inside. Right? All the way up into the mountains, I was irritated. And I was still smoking hashish, and I'd been smoking it for 4 months steadily, and that was not helping my irritation at all, because after a while, it gets you very brittle. And we went up and up, and as we got closer, I realized that something very special was going to happen because Bhagwan Das, who was usually very calm, was starting to show tremendous signs of emotion, and tears were streaming down his face, and I felt that he was getting very excited about getting close to his guru. He had never even mentioned having a guru before, and I didn't even know what kind of a guru it was going to be, you know, what sect or anything. Now, the night before we went to see the guru, I must tell you this, that around 2 in the morning, I had to go to the bathroom, and I went outside, and I was looking up at the stars, and I was thinking about my mother. Now, I left for India in April, in May, end of May, and my mother had died in January. She had died in Boston, and she had died of a blood condition, an over-enlarged spleen and so on. And I wasn't thinking about her death. I had not thought about her death in India. I had thought a lot about her, but about her life and about spiritual things. And I had never talked about her to anybody in India. I thought about her that night, and then I went back to bed. All right, now the next day we're in the Rover and we're going up to the mountains and we come to this little temple by the side of the road, and I think we're just slowing down to let a truck pass, but we stop because there's nothing there but a little temple. And people surround the car lovingly towards this fellow I'm with, and he says, where's the guru? And they point, he's up on a hill. And he goes loping off up this hill, and I'm running behind, and I'm like really bugged now. I mean, I'm being ignored. And after all, he's 23 years old, and I'm, you know, 36 at the time. And the Land Rover's bugging me, and the hashish is bugging me, and I'm just in really bad state, right? And I'm climbing, running up the hill behind him. And when we get to the top of the hill, there is a man sitting with a blanket wrapped around him. Actually, this blanket. And about 10 people, Hindus, are sitting around him. And the fellow I'm with falls flat out in Danda Pranam, in honor, touches the feet of this man who is smiling at him. And I'm standing by, you know, like, what are you supposed to do? You know? I don't know what to do, feeling very sort of uncomfortable. Sort of trying to be out of the way so I don't exist. This man looks up at me and he says to Bhagwan Das, he said, "Have you got a picture of me?" Bhagwan Das says, "Yes." He says, "Give it to him." Meaning me. Bhagwan Das says, "I will." Then he says to me, "You came in a good car?" Now this is in Hindi, only half of which I understand, and there's a translator who's translating along the way, so that together I'm getting the expression. I said, "Yes." He says, "You give it to me?" Oh, wow, you know. So I said, "Well, he says, "You don't like the car?" "It's worth much? Maybe you can get one for me like it?" "Well, perhaps." I don't know what's happening. All I feel is I'm being hustled in a way I don't understand at all. And then a few minutes later, he says to me, "You were out of the stars last night." Now, I was, you've got to understand, I was 100 miles away the night before. "Yes? Acha. You were thinking about your mother." "Acha. She died last year." "She got very big in the belly before she died." "Acha." "She died of spleen." "That's right." Now, to describe what happened to me at that moment, the only metaphor I can use is what happens when a computer is fed an insoluble problem. I mean, I am a rational social scientist, and all the time when people tell me about mystical experiences, it's great, but it happened to you, not me. And people who are having all these other things, and when I've had these weird things under drugs, in my head there's a category of stuff filled with events that happened under drugs, but after all, it happened under drugs, and I was the observer, and I was under drugs too, so how do I know I didn't, you know? I wasn't, you know, this wasn't the hashish. And my mind reached for every, like, could anybody have told him? How would he know? You know, and there was no possible way that I could think of at that moment, or have I ever thought of since, that he could know that. I mean, this is a man, you know, probably he's in his 70s, Hindi, sitting up on a hill, there's no communication, no telephones, no nothing. I'm just a passenger in a car. I haven't even been thinking about how my mother died, so it's not even in my thoughts. It's not like the uppermost thing in my head. My mind went through all the possible possibilities, like a computer just flip, 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 flip. This, you know, it searched in that storage unit, it searched in this storage unit, and finally it does what a computer does when it can't solve a problem. You know, the red light goes on and the bell sounds and the machine stops. And I experienced my mind stopping. It just broke down. My rational mind just couldn't handle the data. And simultaneously, he was looking at me, and I was looking into his eyes, and I felt this extraordinary wrenching in my heart, and I started to cry. And I didn't cry because I was unhappy, and I didn't cry because I was happy. It was just like a flood of tears poured out. And I cried and cried and cried. The closest I can describe it, it's as if I was home. It's as if, yeah, right, whew. Because what I intuitively understood was that I had met someone who knew. If you understand what I mean, I had met somebody whose consciousness, who was a living being who represented this other state of consciousness. I never left that temple again. In fact, I'm literally still there. That evening, I went back. I was taken to another temple about 12 miles away. And I was very emotional, very confused, very emotional. I didn't understand what he had done or why he had done it or what it all meant or anything. I mean, I just didn't, it was just all, no, I couldn't figure it out, in my old term of figure it out. But it felt awful good. And that evening, it crossed my mind that, gee, I was unpacking and I saw this bottle of LSD and I wondered, you know, I've always wondered what LSD is, and here's a man who knows. I mean, he really knows. Because I realized that in order to know what he knew about that spleen, he had to be able to transcend time and space in his consciousness. And therefore, he must know all kinds of things. He'd know what LSD was, and I really must ask him, I thought. The next morning, I was called for and taken to the guru by very loving sadhus, who all treated me like I was a brother who would come home, by the way. I mean, very strange feeling there. And I go up to him and he says, now I have no trouble at all touching his feet. I mean, listen, now I'm, you know, honored to be able to do it. It's just the feeling is entirely different. He says, where's the medicine? Now, the first thing he says to me is, have you any questions? He says, have you got a question? My mind was blank. I was just in complete bliss. No, I don't have any questions. You know, I'm just happy to be here. It's a groove. Where's the medicine? What medicine? Nothing medicine. Johnson First Aid Cream? I don't know. So Bhagwan Das says to me, he means the LSD. Oh, the LSD. It's in the car. Bring the medicine. Okay. Go and I bring the bottle of pills. Pour them out in my hand. What's that? I've got a little of everything in there. So, LSD and a few STP and some energizers and tranquilizers and an old sleeping pill with some mold on it. And, you know, just the things you carry along with you for any occasion. What's that? What's that? What's that? What's that? So I tell him what each thing is. He says, does it give you any siddhis? Somebody says, it means powers. So I thought he meant, being a Westerner, here's an old man who wants physical vitality. He wants one powers, see? So I said, no, it's not. I wish I had vitamins for you, but these aren't them. So I put him all back in the bottle, figuring he's disappointed. What he wanted was some vitamin pills. He must be feeling weak, you know, and I'm a little disappointed. So. So he holds out his hand, so I pour out one white lightning.
That's a very pure LSD pill that is about 300 micrograms. It's 305 exactly, which is a very powerful dose. So I pour a second one. I pour a third one. Now in his hand, he is holding 900 micrograms of very pure LSD. Looks and he goes, okay. Swallows it. I watch it go down his throat. I mean, I really see it go down. So the scientist in me thinks, well, this is going to be interesting. And I settle back at the edge of the crowd to wait. Nothing happened. Nothing happened. All day, nothing happened. He's already there. There's nothing to happen. The week before, a sadhu who takes arsenic, if you take arsenic in very small doses, it's very good for singing bhajan. If you take it in large doses, it's something else. But he had his year's supply, which was enough to kill 10 men. And he was carrying it, and the guru said, you take arsenic. Let me see the arsenic. He took the thing, the block of it, put it in his mouth, chewed it up, and swallowed it. And everybody started to cry, don't leave us. And they wanted to pump his stomach and, you know, the whole thing. And he was just sitting there smiling and nothing happened. That evening when I was back, the evening after that, I was back at my place, and I was thinking, gee, if I'm going to stay around here, one of these days I ought to take a bus and go over and see Lama Govinda, because Lama Govinda is one of the leading interpreters for the West of Tibetan Buddhism, and he's over in Almora, and it would be interesting to see him. We dedicated our book to him. One of the people we dedicated the book to, and I haven't met him, and Tim's seen him, and Ralph's seen him, and so on. I thought about that. The next morning, 8 o'clock, car there with a chauffeur, orders to take me to see Lama Govinda. Right. Four months later, the first time I left the ashram, the temple, I had to go to Delhi about extending my airplane ticket and public health stuff and all that kind of jazz, money problems. I had given a lot of money to some Tibetans and I had to cash traveler's checks and stuff. And I went to Delhi, and by then I was in a different state, as you'll hear later on today. And I did all my business, and then in the afternoon, I decided I'd treat myself. I had been on a very severe regimen, as we will talk about. Went into a restaurant, and I had a vegetarian meal, and then I had ice cream and two biscuits, which was quite a luxury for me. And then I went to the Buddhist mission I was staying at outside of Delhi, and then the next day I got up at 5:30 and I took the bus back and went up to the mountains. And the guru had been up further in the mountains, and a few days later he arrived back, and everybody, the guru's here, and we all jump onto the public buses and rush to the guru. And I go rushing up to him, and I'm just, it's like coming to the sunshine. I mean, that's the feeling you have. And I brought him oranges, and I, you know, fell at his feet, and he was taking the oranges and eating them as like a sign of love. It was, and I had my head down, and he grabbed my hair, and he pulled it back, and he looked at me, and he said, "How'd you like the biscuits?" From the moment I met the guru until I left for America, they completely took over my life. In other words, I experienced what I later guess I would call surrender. But it was just the way it says in the books. It was surrender that is no surrender. I mean, how can you surrender to this? It's like, it's so beyond that. So beyond that. What are you giving up? And this other fellow and I are the only Westerners that are connected with this scene at all that I know of. And it's very quiet and modest. The guru only owns, he owns nothing. He has a blanket. He wears a blanket. And he gave me this, and I gave him another blanket. And his devotees take care of him. And they protect him for themselves. Because if they leave him, he'll just walk off into the woods and they'll never see him again. He is in what is known as Sahaja Samadhi. That is, he is in a state of full consciousness in the body. All times. At all times. There is yet one more very special being I wish to introduce you to. His name is Baba Haridas. By the way, my name is Baba Ramdas now. The guru gave me this name. And when I was sent to America, I was told that Richard Alpert wasn't going to America, that Baba Ramdas was. Baba means grandfather. It is also a title meaning holy man that is used in the Vaishnavite sects in the same way that Swami is used in the Shaivite sects.
WBAI, New York.
Ram is one of the incarnations of Vishnu, who is one of the three manifest forms of Brahman, or the unmanifest beyond it all. And Das means servant, and therefore it means servant of God. Now, Baba Haridas was my teacher. He was a man. This is not the guru. This is my teacher now. This is a disciple of the guru's. He is a Brahmin of the Brahmin caste from southern India. At 8 years old, he left his family and went into the jungle as a jungle sadhu. These are all jungle sadhus. The guru spent maybe 40, 50 years in the jungle, alone in the jungle. Baba Haridas went into, left home at 8, and when he became my teacher, he is 48 years old. He met the guru 15 years ago and has served him ever since. They are in a relationship that you would call complementary, I would say. Haridas Baba is very high, and he has many devotees that for whom he is a guru. He has been mauna, that is silent, for 15 years. I was silent all the time I was at the ashram. I spoke with a chalkboard. He reads and writes 8 languages, 8 different languages, not just different dialects, different languages, and taught me in English, very fluent English. When people give gifts to the guru for building temples and so on, Haridas Baba does all the architectural designing of these buildings, hires all the workmen, supervises all the building, handles all the finances, all the payment, runs all the temples, sleeps 2 hours a night. His total food intake for 15 years is 2 glasses of milk a day. Bus. Period. Weighs 90 pounds. And when the workman can't lift a particularly heavy rock, very special person, very, very much, much light, much light. There is an expression called Tej, which is light. It's a light that comes out of the face. And these people I lived with all had much Tej, much of that, that pran coming out from their face, much light. Now, one of the reasons they have so much light is because the sect I was living with and I am now part of are all brahmachari, which means they are continent. Now, I'd like to make the distinction between celibacy as practiced in Western religions and brahmachari as practiced in this sect. Celibacy is really the suppression of sexual expression. Brahmachari is the process of redirecting the energy for a spiritual purpose. It is what is called the conversion of bindu to ojas. And bindu is energy, which is the form in which pran takes when it is in energy in the lower centers of the body, which one then uses as sexual energy. And the conversion of this up into the energy which is resides in the upper chakras and is for the purpose of spiritual work, that energy is a much finer type of energy, and it's called ojas. And a man who has been continent for many, many years and has practiced something like pranayama, which we'll talk about in a minute, for converting this energy, has stored a great deal of this ojas and has much to work with. And you can tell it by that kind of light that emanates from their face. And it gives them considerable powers to work with. I mean, whatever we might say about Maharishi Mahesh and his attachment to worldly things, and his limits as a spiritual guide for the West. And there is no doubt that he is attached. Nevertheless, he has been brahmachari for some 50 years and has much power. He would have to have had that power to have been able to create the even a passing thing like he did. Now, when it was first suggested to me by Bhagwan Das, that Bhagwan Das was the traveling companion. Bhagwan is the name of God, and Das is servant again. And I'll talk about the servant role in a few minutes. When Bhagwan Das first said to me, I'm a brahmachari, and he explained what it was, and he said he thought that's what I should do. I found that pretty humorous. Having been in a Freudian analysis, and taken much delight in my, much delight in my sexual life. The thought of, as a Westerner, the thought of giving up sex just seemed absurd to me. And I said, well, you're not expecting me to do that. That's just out of the question. And he looked at me with infinite compassion and said no more about it. Later, he said about something else, now, what everything you do is important. Later, none of it will matter. In other words, at the stage you're at, in the stage of purification, or in the stage of mobilizing and directing the energies of your body, everything you do is relevant to your spiritual journey. Later on, when you have become clearly centered in that place, when you are in a state where you don't need to depend on your work to keep you there, then nothing will matter. You can do everything. Then you can have whatever sex you want. But you see, the paradox of the game, ladies and gentlemen, is what the deal you're being offered is. You can have all of your desires, any desire you've ever dreamed of having, you will have all of your desires fulfilled just as soon as you give up all desire. Okay? It's very simple. You can have it all. You can have it all. All the power you wanted, all the fame you wanted, all the sexual gratification you wanted, the money, anything you want. You name it. You name it. But you can't desire it. Therefore, the path is the path of total renunciation. You don't renounce the act. That would be hypocrisy, to renounce the act and still desire it. You renounce the desire for the act. That's the key. The renunciation of the desire for the act. See, in other words, well, you understand that. As my teacher wrote on his chalkboard, desire is a trap, desirelessness is moksha, liberation. Desire is the creator, desire is the destroyer, desire is the universe. And when you reflect on it, you can see how your desires create the world in which you live. And in psychological terms, you can say motivation affects perception. It's the same statement. The only thing is that in psychology, all you can do is trade one motive for another, because the models don't allow for the possibility of being somebody that has transcended desire. There isn't that place in the psychological theoretical design of man. That the theories of psychology do not allow for the possibility that man could exist in a desireless state, you see. The closest they get are dealing with what they call needs and drives, which are social drives and physiological needs, and they'll allow that you can get along without minimized social drives, but when they get to physiological needs, they're just, it's too powerful for them to think about. And when you have met a yogi, as I have, who has been buried alive for 3 years, where, as he explained it to me, the only oxygen he needed was that necessary to feed his brain cells and his heart muscle. And the only error they made was they didn't pack his right arm well enough, so the ants ate it all away. And his cells of his body stored the oxygen that was necessary for this purpose. Then you come back to psychology, and the physiological psychologist talking about the need for oxygen. And then you meet Haridas Baba, who drinks 2 glasses of milk a day, and you read the Public Health, World Health Organization folders, and this man is dead. There's no doubt about it, he's dead. He can't survive. He's got rickets, scurvy, and he's dead. But there he is, lifting big rocks, running up and down hills, sleeping 2 hours a night, full of light and energy. It pushes your Western security that we really know, you know, just a little bit. Now, brahmachari is one of the 5 categories of yama, which is one of the 8 legs of Ashtanga Yoga, which is called 8-legged yoga. It's also known in the West as Raja Yoga. Some of you, I suspect, have seen Vivekananda's book or the Isherwood Prabhavananda book called How to Know God. There are a number of these books. The interesting thing for me was that I had been in Wisner's bookstore down in the basement, and I had found Vivekananda's Raja Yoga, and I had bought it in 1962, taken it home, and started to read it. And it just, I didn't like his looks, you know. He was kind of fat, and he looked kind of like, I don't know, he didn't turn me on. And I just figured, well, you know, it would be one thing. I was such a phony. I mean, if Aldous Huxley had said to me, Dick, you really ought to read Vivekananda's book, I would have read that until I understood it, because, you know, some important person had told me to do it. But because I found it in the basement of Wisner's bookstore, it was dusty, and I read it. And when I ran up the obstacle of not liking his face, and it was all in there, you see. Everything I needed to know was in there. But see, I wasn't ready to see it. That was about it. There, you have to get to the point where you begin to understand what this readiness to see or readiness to hear. You know, what does it mean that we are gathered together, that I can say this and that you can hear it? You know, what does that say about all of us? Who are we? Now, Haridas Baba was such a subtle teacher that I never realized for almost 3 months that he was teaching me Ashtanga Yoga. Because he was teaching it to me, I was an educational psychologist, and therefore I understand theories of education, learning, rather. And I've worked in elementary schools and junior high schools, and no matter how subtle any teaching techniques I've ever seen, I've never seen one like this. Because he taught it from inside me. It was just emerging out of me. There would be just the slightest felt need on my part for something, and then the next chapter would be there. And when I remember one night talking a lot, I mean writing a lot, and I said, I'm sorry I had so much to say. He said, I made you. Right. Now, Ashtanga Yoga, the eight-legged, eight-armed yoga, consists of yama, niyama, asana, pranayama, pratyahara, dharana, dhyana, and samadhi. The last four, pratyahara, dharana, dhyana, and samadhi, are all concerned with, well, except for samadhi, are concerned with meditation. And samadhi is the final state in which it all comes together. The first two, yama and niyama, are concerned with purification and getting yourself straight. Now, I used to say when I was lecturing, the year before I went to India, I used to go around and people would say, gee, why do we always come down? I used to say, well, the problem is I feel in myself I'm not straight enough yet. I've got to get things straight. And I, being a psychologist, would say to people, you've got to get your human contract straight. That means if you've left bad vibrations behind you because you walked out on your parents or you walked out on a chick and the baby or you quit a job or you've done something that left bad vibrations, you've got to go and straighten all that up because it brings you down because those vibrations are around all the time. That was the closest I could get to what purification meant. Now I'll tell you a little more about the 10 components of yama and niyama that make up purification. Asana is concerned with, which is the third of the eight legs, is concerned with this. This is an asana. This is, the traditional one you know of is the lotus position or Padmasana, where the feet are up on the thighs. And Hatha Yoga is the way in which we think in the West of that component of yoga concerned with the body. Primarily, asanas are used in Raja Yoga or Ashtanga Yoga in order to get your body into... It's used to purify the nerves, to open the nerves, and it's used for the endocrine system, and it's used in order to allow you to be able to sit like this for long times, because when you do meditation, you have to be able to find a seat where you're not, you know, moving around for maybe 6, 8, 10 hours. And this, where your body is forming a triangle on the floor, is a one, finally, when you've mastered it, you can sit there indefinitely. It just doesn't matter. And so a lot of the asanas that I do every day are for to get your body able to do this and for the nerves, which I'll tell you more about later. The fourth one is pranayama, which is... controlling the prana, or that is the energy system in your body. Now, there are two components that you've got to work with. One is the energy system, and the other is the direction of the energy. You can think of it like a laser beam. The game is, if I can define it in game terms, the game is to get control of the energy in your body and start to direct it and release a great deal of energy that you only know about when you take drugs for most of the people in the West, because it's usually closed off completely. To control that energy, and then through meditation techniques to be able to direct the energy. And then the game is, as meditation, as we'll see when we talk about meditation, is to make the mind one-pointed, that is, narrow the beam down till it's directed, so you can completely direct it against one point, and then turn it back on itself. And then go through and out. This is, I mean, I'm giving you the simplest kind of visual description of what the process is. Now, so pranayama is the energy control, and it, let me tell you in the in the simplest terms, it has completely blown my mind, pranayama. It is just extraordinary, really extraordinary. It's very exacting and delicate work, but it is quite extraordinary. And I will, before the afternoon's up, give you some of the basic breathing things that are preliminary to it, that are extremely good even in one's daily life when one is living as a grusta, as a householder out in the world. Then there is pratyahara, the meditation ones at the end, and finally samadhi, and different levels of samadhi, which we'll talk about later on. Now, yama, which is the first of the purification categories, consists of brahmachari, which I've already talked about, or sexual continence. That means holding your sexual energy for other purposes. Now, this is really involved with the control of the muladhara, the first chakra, and just redirecting the energy. Almost all Westerners, or all people, have available all of their energy in usually the first three chakras, the one of which is right at the stomach point, one is below the navel, and the third is like the three nerves right at the halfway between the genitals and the anal sphincter, right in the middle there. And the energy is used for action, for sex, for eating, for things like that, for rajas-type activities. And the process of taking that energy and moving it up the spine is what we will be talking about when we talk about pranayama. Now, the second of the five categories of yama is, these aren't ordered particularly, there is truthfulness. Now, it's a very funny thing what's happened to us in the West about truthfulness. We have developed what we would call the socially expedient selective report, which is, I mean, what I said to you at the beginning, I really meant, I have got to be able to tell you everything. In other words, I have got to be able to give you unqualified truth. So there is no question you can ask me that I have not got to be able to answer, because there's nowhere to hide in that sense. And any time you start to do any kind of distortion of truth, you pull yourself further and further and further into a separate, trapping yourself in that separate package, which is the game you're trying to get out of, the thing you're trying to get out of. You can't afford dishonesty, is the way it works out. You just can't afford it. It's just too costly. Now, I recall two incidents in the West which are very relevant here. One was when I was a professor at Stanford. And all the psychology introductory students had to serve in experiments. And deception was used as part of these experiments. A student would be told, this thing you do on this will count on your grade. It's very important, because they wanted to create stress. Then at the end they'd say, it was all, we were only kidding. We're psychologists, you know, I'm sorry. Now, I was giving this course, and there were 500 students in it, and I was told to make an announcement saying that an important, they all had to come to a certain place, and they would all be given a test, and it would affect their grade. And I said, well, it won't affect their grade. And the man that gave me the paper, this boy, this graduate student, said, I know, but you've got to say it, because we've got to create the stress. I said, well, I'm their professor. You can't ask me to lie to them. So he went back and told his professor, who was a big wheel in the department. I was an acting instructor, and this other guy was a full professor. Full professor came and said, I'll take all the responsibility. I said, I don't care whether you'll take all the responsibility or not. I'm the teacher in this course. He says, well, we'll see about that. So off we marched to the chairman of the department. Chairman of the department said, well, Dick, don't you think you're being a bit naive? I said, no, I don't think I'm being a bit naive. But now you see the game had changed. Now it wasn't just me against the professor. It was my job and career and future. I mean, I was suddenly, you know, a civil liberties case, and a few minutes before I had just... So the chairman said, well, I'll tell you what, I'll make the announcement. You just introduce me. Can you imagine, the chairman of the department is going to come in and lie because the head of the, right? So I said, okay. See, I sold out at that point, right? I found my way, I copped out, which I did many times in the course of being a psychologist, because it was the zeitgeist. Everybody was doing it. It was the thing. How are we supposed to get data if we don't create those conditions, right? And I was being treated as some naive fool. Now, the other experience I had, before I went to India, I was with a group of hippies from San Francisco and Los Angeles, and we were in Wata Villa in Arizona with the Hopi Indian elders. We were trying to arrange for a Hopi hippie bean, right? And there were 20 or 30 of us that had come down, and I was traveling with this girl, Caroline, in a bus that I had, a big school bus, and we had come by, and there was this Sunday morning meeting. I remember it very well. It was in a Hopi hut, and around this table were sitting men, the youngest of whom was 60, and they probably ranged to about 105, you know, and they were just beautiful men, just beautiful. And the youngster of the group, of the man in middle age, was explaining an incident that they were dealing with, and he said that one of the young Hopis had been driving a truck, and the truck had been in an accident with one of the Bureau of Indian Affairs government cars, which had five government men in it. And it was not the Indian boy's fault. And the next day, the police came along and they found a liquor bottle in the gutter, and they said that the boy had been drinking, right? And then he looked at me and he said, the boy had not been drinking, he spoke truth. And the way he said that, I realized that in their culture, in the world he lived in, it was still the world where you asked a person and they told you the truth, and there weren't contracts, and there wasn't doubt, well, is he really telling the truth? Did he swear on the Bible? Because in his world, you spoke truth. And I thought about what, you know, when we finally came in and civilized these savages, what we brought with us. So I started to Now, the reason I tell you those two stories is because what would happen is, as I would proceed to entertain each of these tasks of my work in India, it would take me back into all of these reflections, because I was living, they put me in a room in a small temple. The room was about, quarter of this room. I had a mat on the floor, a table with for puja, for doing my religious things, a desk I could write on, a charcoal brazier for at night when it was really cold, a lota, a water pot.
WBAI, New York.
And that was it. That was it. Cement room. Very cold. I had a blanket. My living regimen was up at around 6 usually. That was late. I mean, they were all up and away, but I was a Westerner and they sort of let me slosh around in my own inefficiency. Off to the river with my lota for my morning snan or bath, which barefoot through the snow is quite an experience if you're not used to it. Then back for pranayam, for breathing, for asanas, then morning tea. Look at the river and drink the tea and read either the Bhagavad Gita or the Book of Tao. Meditate, reflect on it, and then I'd meditate for a few hours with some formal meditation. Haridas Baba would come in a couple of days a week at around 11:30 in the morning. He'd spend maybe a half hour, an hour teaching me. At around 1 o'clock, I would be given my meal for the day. It would be brought to the door, which was kedri, which is rice and dal, with dal is like a lentil mixed together, and sometimes sabji, a vegetable, which usually turned out to be potato or something like that. And I would say that food costs about 11 cents a day or something like that. That was that. The year before, I had lived in New York City with an English girl on 57th Street, living in the style to which I was accustomed. And in 6 months, I think I had spent something like $12,000. In this comparable six-month period in India, I spent $180. I didn't spend it. They spent it. They never charged me a penny for anything. They bought my clothes, my food. They just took, and they never even mentioned it, or even there was no contract, there was no requirement that I stay or anything. This wasn't it. They just took it over. They just assumed it was all the way it's supposed to be, you know, supposed to be there, right? And then after the meal, I'd rest for a few minutes and then meditate some more. And then usually around the middle of the afternoon, make a hot lemon drink with honey and adrak ginger and gur, brown sugar, cardamom seeds. Then pranayama again, asanas again. Then it's dark, and then a glass of warm milk and honey, and then to bed. And start the whole thing again. Right. Now, that situation, if you repeat that long enough all by yourself, there was a month, for example, when Haridas Baba was away, when I saw no human being at all. The food was left outside the door, and I just went outside to go to the latrine or to take my bath, and the rest of the time you're just sitting there. You go through a number of changes when you're used to being an active Westerner, and where you turn on the radio or you go to a movie or you, you know, let's get in the car and go for a ride or pick up a book, right?
And there were times when I was climbing the walls, literally climbing the walls. I mean, I would look through my window, I could see the road at the distance, and once a day a bus went by. And I would get so that I would have fantasies, the richest fantasies about getting on that bus, and it would go to Delhi, and I had an airplane ticket, and I'd get on the airplane, and I'd be in San Francisco, and I'd go to the Fillmore, and I'd build up and up, and I'd carry the whole fantasy up to a whole... I'd watch myself do this, because in the silence and emptiness, there was a chance to just watch your whole mind unfold. It was very, very hard work, let me tell you. I mean, it took much more... I mean, Gurdjieff says the first rule is you can't suffer. And I was busy suffering for a long time before I saw that I was busy suffering, and then, of course, I had to stop suffering.
The program you are about to hear was recorded at the Bucks County Seminar House on September 15, 1968. Dr. Richard Alpert, now known as Baba Ram Das, was one of the psychologists who, along with Dr. Timothy Leary, started the now famous experiments with LSD and other drugs at Harvard University. Along with the experiments with LSD came a renewed interest in certain Oriental religions and disciplines, and some of those people originally working with drugs have now become very involved with what is called the religions of the East. These religions, at least in the West, often appear non-worldly. That is, of course, debatable and from many angles. It is clear, however, that deep involvement in some of the recently imported systems of thought does often lead to a politics, or shall we say a non-politics, that disturbs many people. The producer hopes that this production does justice to Baba Ram Das's lecture.
The other way I had used sex, besides for the social aspects of it, was as a what I called in my naivete, I was calling tantric practices. That is, using the external world or the world of desire to go beyond desire. Well, any Westerner that thinks he can do with sex is a better man than I am, I'll tell you, because if you start, it's one thing. I'll give you an example with food. Here's a good example. I'm a very oral guy. I was brought up in a Jewish middle-class family where, you know, where food is love. It's just a very simple equation. There's no, you know, it's not a function of anything else, just love, food, love. Thanksgiving, big turkeys, it's all very clear. And I can remember all the meals, and that's where the love, oh boy. I was always overweight and so on. It was always a big hustle for me, a hassle. It was their hustle, my hassle. All right, now I'm sitting there with my bowl of rice. Well, now, the bowl of rice is certainly not brisket and tzimmus and all the things I'm used to, see? But it doesn't matter to me because I have such a thing about food that it could be practically anything, and I'll just get into it like I'm climbing into a hot bath, you know? I mean, it's just, it's food, right? And I've got a special world for food. You just enjoy the feeling of it going down your gullet and the, you know, and oh, and the full and, oh, all those feelings, right? Desire, 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 desire everywhere. Okay, I don't mind giving up. I'm sitting in an ashram. There are no women around. I don't mind giving up sex. I don't mind giving up warmth. I don't mind any of those things. Everything's pretty cool. I don't mind giving up books and all that, but food, the delight of eating food, they're not going to take away from me, see? They and me. Right? Well, I wrestled with this for quite a while, and I'm told that on Mangalam, on Tuesday, you don't take food until nightfall. We fast on Tuesday. All right, every Yom Kippur when I was a Jew, I fasted. It's all right.
But when you were a Jew in Yom Kippur and you fasted, you thought about food all afternoon, you know, in preparation for eating. And now, of course, it's just that every Tuesday we'll fast, okay? Right? It wasn't very painful. So I fasted Tuesday, and then Wednesday, the guy that made the lunch was away 1 week, and so no lunch came. And I got, you know, like, if I had had a watch, it would have been that kind of operation. And so I figured, well, this must be some lesson I'm being taught, so I go without food. So I had my milk at night, I didn't even notice it. So the next day I said to Haridas Baba very proudly, ego, you know, the great thing about your ego, it's so cute. Just when you think you've done something, it walks around behind you and pats you on the back and says, good, you know, and there it is again, you know, that's ego. So said to Haridas Baba the next day, well, I went 2 days without eating, and I didn't even notice it. I wrote on my chalkboard. He said, well, why don't you keep on? He said, it's the new moon. He says, it is a good practice to give your intestines a rest and to increase your health. And it is good for discipline, it's tapas. On the new moon, it is good to fast for 9 days. Okay, all right. You know, I can bathe in the river, but I got all, you know. Mm-hmm. Well, after about the fourth day, I'm like dizzy and, you know, you take water, right? I took tea in the morning, I was chickened out a little bit. Tea was my one luxury I never gave up. I mean, I gave up coffee and smoking and drugs, and all, although nobody told me to, but I took tea once a day. Now, after the fifth day, I started to cease to notice it, and then by the eighth day, it was just perfectly great, and I was very high. Oh, boy, was I just, my head was so clear, and I was feeling so good. By the ninth day, during those 9 days, I was having fantasies at night. And I would dream of turkey dinners, and I would dream of steaks at Original Joe's in San Francisco, and lobster Savannah at Lockober's in Boston, and, you know, and French restaurants in New York, and I had all of my gourmet, because I used to, I mean, I was so high, I used to get Gourmet Magazine, you know, and cook all those things, you know, I mean, I was so trapped by the subtle sphere, that's what it is, it's the subtle sphere, the sphere of the senses, and I was so into it, and so the fantasies just like, and I taste the stuff, you know, and I was just eating it all the time. And of course, who was I fooling, you know, when I'd go to see the guru, like if I'd be at my room and I'd dream about something in America, the next day, if I happened to be brought to the guru, which didn't happen often, I didn't see him very often at all, he'd say, you were in America last night, right? He checked in on where my head was and, you know, it was somewhere else. Right? So there's no hiding. I mean, there's no, all right. So the first fast, I was full of turkeys and all that stuff. By the second 9-day fast, the second time I did this, now my fantasies were only of things I could eat there. So I'd start a fantasy, big bowls of spinach with lemon. In other words, I kept the oral thing. I had just narrowed it to, you know, I had, because I knew now I was going to probably be vegetarian for the rest of my life. I mean, it looked, they said it will take you 3 years to completely convert your body. And the argument behind vegetarian thinking for them, I'm doing it because I'm told to do it. I mean, people come and say, what is your theory about diet? And I've gotten into so many hassles about that. I remember Newsweek magazine quoted me as saying about the macrobiotic diet, well, it gets you high. Which, and then people were dying and, you know. There are so many diet attitudes like this. I take dairy products, and macrobiotics keeps you away from dairy products, and so on. But the diet is designed to I can best explain that to you by the next category in Yama, which is non-killing. Their thinking is that you emit a set of, that we are aware of one another at many other levels than at the gross body level. And we emit what you might call vibrations, or finer stuff, if you will, than gross body things. They're not available to our gross senses. Just like some people see auras in other people. And these vibrations are determined by what you are and what you eat and what you think and what you feel. Now, the problem is, if you're going to sit in a room for 10, 12 hours not moving, if you eat foods which contain, just imagine this following process, which is not unreasonable. An animal is killed. At the moment of death, it goes through a very violent experience, and it releases a lot of adrenaline and a lot of the kind of endocrine material into the cells that are connected with action. When you eat that and make that part of your body, when you then call upon your cells, when you're working, when you get subtle enough in your senses so that you are in tune with your body is giving you the message of what you have eaten, literally. And the argument that they present is that you cannot afford to eat highly spiced foods that will arouse your sexual passions or that part of your endocrine system. You can't afford to eat foods that are connected with violence in any way. You just can't afford it. And like the teacher says, there are other things that are just wonderful living with jungle sadhus. The teacher says, snakes no heart. Right. Meaning, a snake knows where you're at. See, if you live in the jungle, you live in a different world than you do in the, you know, in the jungle of New York City. And in that jungle, that's why you see these pictures of saints sitting with wild animals all around them, because they can sit with wild animals all around them, because they don't set off any of the vibrations that make animals fear them. And so I don't wear or eat anything connected with animals. Even the sandals I have, they come from the Gandhi ashram, which is very funny. They make leather sandals out of cows that died naturally. So that when a cow dies naturally in Delhi, you call up the Gandhi ashram and they send over a truck and they take the skin and they make sandals out of it. And those you can wear because that does different vibrations. All right, so I'll later tell you how I got out of the diet problem, or the food problem, because it involves meditation. Will leave me with my fantasies of spinach. Non-stealing, another one of Yama things, not taking anything that doesn't belong, that belongs to someone else, which is logical because it just creates bad. That's like a social rule. It's like a commandment. And then that's brahmachari, truth, or non-lying, non-stealing, non-killing. And the final one is not taking possessions, not receiving. It's called not receiving gifts. And what it means, as close as I can feel it, is not to have any attachment to any possessions. And when people give you something, which I'm giving it to you, and you say, I am accepting it, coming along with all of that are all of the things that come with the contract, contract you're making with that other human being. And you get a lot more than the gift, as you all know who have been in the gift giving and receiving. Very few things are given without attachment. And the only thing you can receive is something that is given without attachment. You can receive anything if it's given without attachment. You can use anything if you use it without attachment. But if you are attached to it, then the littlest thing is too much. Now, that's part of that renunciation matter again. And it is also one of the basic requirements of pursuing sadhana, or the spiritual path, is the state of virag, it's called, V-A-I-R-A-G, virag, or non-attachment, or being done with it all. And that's part of why I had to tell you about all of that early stuff that was happening to me, about the Mercedes and the motorcycle and all that stuff. Because I was very, very fortunate, you see, in that by the time I was like 28 or 9 years old, I had pretty much had what society had to offer, what Western society had, what the great society was going to give. I had one of the greatest academic jobs. I had all the material possessions I could want. And I saw in my heart that that wasn't where it was at. And that's what virag is. You see, now if you're lucky and you're born, you're a very high person and you're in a very high reincarnation, you're born with that virag. You never feel any attachment to things. You use them always and you don't care about them. But most people, and I analyzed, I made charts while I was in India about the onset of virag towards different things. And there were some things like attachments to, you know, like fame and power and sex and security and things like that that I wasn't finished with yet. I just had to recognize I wasn't done with yet. But virag is one of the prime requirements, and you can assess in your own life where you're at in relation to that. Because you can have everything as long as it doesn't matter, as long as it doesn't matter to you. You know, I can get into my father's new Cadillac and go zooming down the road and break up. It's the funniest thing I've done in weeks, you know. Because it doesn't make the least bit of difference. When I'm walking barefoot in India, it's the same state. Because you finally realize that what you're doing is you're developing a place inside where you live, which makes all of that irrelevant. All of that irrelevant. Niyama is cleanliness, first thing, internal and external cleanliness. And it's a little difference. The hippie scene in America has gotten so much of, you see, America has gotten to be a whole deodorant and plastic floor covering type culture so much. Everything is so protected to be cleaner and cleaner and cleaner and cleaner. That the way and the form in which rebellion takes its way for a kid that was brought up in that is, you know, I won't bathe, or I'll just, you know, those things aren't important. And it's very interesting that the yogis in India are very clean people, extremely clean people. I mean, they really, except for ones that are in special sects, where, but even that, dirt isn't the same thing as it is to us, because they'll clean their hair with ashes, see, which we would call dirty, but they use it as a cleaning process to keep the lice out and keep the oils and so on. So there is a lot of concern with keeping your body clean. It's like the theory is this is the temple in which your spirit resides, and it's temple maintenance. You got to take care of the temple. Now, there are a lot of other things I learned, by the way, which are very interesting, like going to the toilet squatting, right? Also, the left and the right hand. You wipe yourself with water, with a lota, after you finish going to the toilet, with your left hand, right? And you eat with your right hand. And these are just the way, I'm left-handed, so I was nearly in a bad bind, you know. They said, don't stick your left hand in the food bowl, or you're liable to get it taken off. It's a very bad social etiquette thing. Now, what happened to me was somebody who had been brought up in this antiseptic world that we live in, you know, you don't touch your feces. What kind of thing is that? You know, and don't get your hands out of the food. What do you think silverware is for? Suddenly to be, you know, this business of picking up the food and like this and cleaning myself and getting back, it was like coming back into my biological foundation, if you will. I mean, it felt very natural. And now I still maintain all these habits here in the United States. On toilet bowls, I sit on the seat, stand on the seat. And it's very good for your intestines and things like that, too. And I eat by myself in my cabin in New Hampshire where I live, in my little cabin. And I eat with my hands. I make my own food because the when food is cooked, the vibrations of the cook, when there's fire involved, enter the food. That's why I can't eat in restaurants. I mean, I've got to explain to you that I can talk with you at great length about what we can adapt from what I've learned for the Westerner living in the world, living as a grusta, as a householder. But what I'm telling you now is what it's like to go on the total trip, if you will, of a renunciate who has been, as you can see, a very worldly guy. You know? And what you give up and what it means, and what it, you know, like, ice cream has a gelatin base, I find out, and gelatin is made of cow's intestines. It's the end of ice cream, unless you make your own.
No hamburger stands, you know, none of that, of course. What do you understand all? All right. Now, the other parts of niyama are very important. One of them is contentment. The Book of Tao says, once be content. You know that one in the Tao that says, starts out with, when the way exists, coach horses fertilize the fields. When the way does not exist, war horses breed in the parks. That's the line, right? And the end of that is, once be contented, once know contentment, and you will always be so. And the idea is, whatever the situation is, you're content with it. You just experience contentment. You just let it happen. This is it. This is the way it is. You must differentiate between what is called internal freedom and external freedom first. to the extent that you have internal freedom, then you do karma yoga. That is, you do the thing out in the world that is best suited to your capacities and your skills. And you do the thing which is most going to help other people with their opportunities to be liberated also. To the extent that you do not have internal freedom, anything you think you are doing in the outside world is probably not what you're doing at all. For example, if you don't like a condition that exists in the world and you protest against it, a little analysis from one level up indicates that you create the polarization, that in the sense, and this I'm shortcutting a whole long lecture to tell you this, that just the hippies produce the police just as the police produce the hippies. I mean, in other words, only to the extent that you can protest with no attachment can you protest without creating vibrations which create the opposite of what you try to create. For example, if you read the Bhagavad Gita, this talks specifically to this topic, right? Now, there are levels at which you look at suffering. See, let us take just for a moment, let us digress to take Buddha's Four Noble Truths. The first noble truth says, all life is suffering, birth is suffering, growing old is suffering, sickness is suffering, death is suffering, getting what you don't want is suffering, not getting what you do want is suffering. All suffering, right? Suffering in life. Second of the noble truths is the cause of suffering is craving. That is, it is your desires. If you didn't desire anything, you couldn't suffer from not getting it. If you didn't desire life, you wouldn't suffer about death. Suffering is the result of desire, in the sense that. Third noble truth is, to give up suffering, you give up craving. I remember talking to Emmett Grogan, who was the head of the Diggers at one time. And he was in New York, and he was trying to turn the Puerto Ricans on.
WBAI New York,
he said. That was his statement. But they didn't want to be turned on. Because they hadn't yet gone on the middle class trip, as he put it. I'm just giving you his story now. And down on Avenue A and B and all through there were living hippies who came out of middle class scenes who were down living there, and then there were Puerto Ricans who were living there. And the hippies were saying, man, wow, this is freedom. And the Puerto Ricans were saying, oh, wow, we got to get out of here. I'm feeding in bits of data that will deal with the problem that you're raising. In Benares, which is perhaps the holiest city, or at least one of the holiest cities of India, Benares is where people go to die, because if you die there, you get off the wheel, you finish with your karma. Just by dying in Benares, you get burned at the burning ghat over the Ganga, and you get thrown, your body, your bones get thrown into the Ganges River. And Krishna is there to, with Kali dances, and it's all instant. Before I went, when I was on the Land Rover part of my trip, I went to Benares, and I took LSD in Benares. And I walked down by the Burning Ghat, and here were all these people, like you'd find a man. This is the way he was moving through the street, right? People with leprosy, people with the worst deformities, the old people, and many of them had these little sack where they had enough money to pay for the wood for their burning. You know, they were begging for that money for that wood. Now, when I was high, I couldn't look these people in the eye because it was very powerful. They had nothing to hide. They were so there. I mean, it was like too much of a confrontation for me for some reason. And it all looked very horrible to me at that point. I was in the Land Rover at a good hotel, and, you know, and I couldn't look them in the eye because I had some traveler's checks left, you know. And they were saying, here we are, and this is it. And I was like playing like, here I am, and this is it. But I knew I had these traveler's checks stashed away. You know, I couldn't be straight with them, because to be straight with them meant sharing everything I had with them. Later, when I came back to Benares, after I had been traveling with Bhagwan Das for a while, I began to realize that these people who I was looking at with such pity was the word, were looking at me with pity because they had made it. They were getting close to that place where they were going to get off the wheel. Right? They looked at me as a Westerner, knowing that as a Westerner I wasn't going to be burned at Benares. And this poor guy, he's just in the wheel of life and death. And these people who are my Western mind categorized as suffering, pity, do something, their state of mind just was something unfathomable to me. Now, but then take somebody who is suffering, who says, I'm suffering, and what emotion can it arouse in a conscious being? The only emotion that is left to a conscious being, and this is something you really have to think about because it is most profound, the only emotion left to a conscious being is that of infinite, unbearable compassion. Boss, period. That's it. No pity. No joy, no anger, no I'm in love with you, all gone. Just compassion. Compassion that sees the poignancy of the life process. That of you which truly is you, which is what we're talking about, that inner place, does nothing. It never does anything. It's just there. It's there in its full glory all the time. You are in your body. Your body has certain karma to work out. You will do things in the world as long as you stay in your body. Now, is what you do irrelevant or not? You see that? Is where we're dealing, what we're dealing with here. And from the point of view of enlightenment, what you do there is only one direction that I understand, and that is you work for your enlightenment and the enlightenment of others. And anything that fits into that mold is suitable, it's what's called in Buddhist terms, right livelihood or right action. Right action, okay? Now, that may come in strange packages, right? And, for example, for a long time, I was a therapist, a psychotherapist, and I used to love my patients so much. Man, I couldn't give them enough. You know, I felt so sorry for them. They were suffering so. And I was just like the Jewish mother, you know. Oh, you know, I'd see you in the middle of the night if you need me. I'm here all the time. Well, what we had was the most neurotic, symbiotic relationship, you know. I mean, I needed them as much as they needed me. And the question of whether I wasn't nurturing their dependency, you know. I mean, what I do now with a person who wants to get straight is all I do is I sit and I do my thing, see, and I stay in my place, and out of that place, then I can help them. Because there's no me that cares. I gotta not care before I can do anything that can really help them. Before I'm not just creating more of my own desire.
Say you and I do the same, we do the same thing.
Yeah.
And I do it because it makes me feel important. But you do it out of a feeling of compassion. Okay, that I can see. But it seems to me with the attitude of moksha, which I define as having a maximum of concern with a minimum of attachment, there's a tendency to not care.
You know, well, not caring, that's interesting.
Not caring in the sense of being indifferent.
Yes, right, exactly. Well, now, I've been dealing with that because I have a lot of these young kids that come to visit me up at my cabin from the local area in New Hampshire. And when I talk about non-attachment, they say, sure, man, it doesn't matter. And when I hear it, I get all uptight because when they say it, it sounds like they don't give a damn,
right?
And unbearable compassion, you got to understand what that means. That means you are part of it all. You're doing all the suffering. You're experiencing all the pain. Compassion means you are, the compassionate smile of the Buddha is a full understanding of all the suffering from inside. It's not non-involvement in the sense, it's non-attachment, but not non-involvement. He's very involved, he's just not attached. You see that? And it is true that it is often used as a rationalization, you know, the philosophical position of non-attachment, for it doesn't matter what I do, but you realize that that is a desire. You've got to see the game, the way the game works. That to say, the hell with you, is part of my desires. And therefore, I'm creating karma for myself when I do that. And all I'm doing is creating more sorrows, more troubles for myself for lives to come by doing that. Right? And I'm also keeping you separate from me, which is slowing down my own liberation as well as yours. You see that? So that I would share with you the feeling that at the level of intellect or mind, when a person says, the hell with it, it doesn't matter, it's a very different thing from the compassionate non-attachment that we're talking about. Because like, let's say somebody is suffering because they're about to die, right? Now, what can you feel? From where I'm sitting, you know, what's so big about dying, man? It's just a change of, you know, your energy form. It's not a big deal. But you try explaining that to a Westerner, right? You know, I'm going to die, man. I mean, it's one thing for you to talk about, but I'm going to die, right? Now, what can you feel for them? See, you can feel, all you can feel is compassion. You can't lie, and you can't, I don't feel any pity for them. I mean, I don't know what pity is. I mean, pity is just another ego game on my part. All I can feel is compassion. And I can try to be straight with them. I can try to be completely straight with them. In other words, always try to be there at the level of as much consciousness as I can muster. That's what I can do for another human being. All we can do for another human being is be. The doing is not us. The doing is done. And what you do is learn to tune in on the harmonies of the universe and then do what is called for. You float downstream, in this sense. And if that requires you going out and helping somebody who is suffering, you do it. But it is no different an act than you going to the movies from where you're sitting, because you're doing it without attachment. It's a hard one from social to deal with the issue of social responsibility from and compare it with the issue of enlightenment, because social responsibility is primarily thought of in the West as an ego trip. It is an ego trip. I am a good person. I do good things. It's the good and evil level. And you have got to realize that enlightenment has nothing to do with good and evil. I was sitting in the woods, and I thought, one day I woke up, I've written this thing, I didn't bring it over with me, but I've written a thing, and it says, I was sitting here this morning, and the sun was streaming in the window in this peaceful valley, and I was just feeling great bliss and contentment, and I thought, I was reading from the Bhagavad Gita about the battles and doing battles without being attached to the fruits of the battle. And I thought, well, my battle is the battle of consciousness. And at this moment, it's raging, the police versus the hippies and this versus that and so on back in an airplane. What am I doing here? What is this valley? Am I copping out? Is this a rear-line re-education camp? Is this some kind of am I frightened? What is it I'm doing here? You know, how can I justify? Because I feel like I'm a very socially responsible human being. How can I justify this in relation to that? And I remember when Allen Ginsberg called me to help organize the spring mobilization march a couple of years ago, and I said, Allen, I can't do that because I can't march without attachment. I'm not ready to do it. I'm not conscious enough. Maybe you are, but I'm not. And if I march with anger, then I'm just creating anger. I can't do it. Because I can't justify that that's a good act. I'm not sure about what that means. Now, I thought about that and how everybody was down on me for doing that and, you know, very bad, pretty bad. And then I realized that the battle that I was fighting was the battle that everybody is fighting, was the battle inside of an individual, not outside. And it didn't matter what you were doing outside. You're still confusing the internal and the external issues. Whether you go to a retreat or don't go to a retreat is irrelevant as far as the thing we're talking about. This is orthogonal to it. It's indifferent to it. Your job all the time is to be becoming, because if you look at it, if you look at the history of mankind, you realize that the history of mankind is the history of consciousness, of the conscious beings. that the changes, the major leaps of mankind have been made by the more conscious beings. And that Gurdjieff is absolutely right, and these people that have talked about it, that the that what we are doing is increasing the sum of human consciousness that's available. I mean, you can look now at the nuclear things and all, and the inadequacy of the minds of the people that are running governments to deal with the problems that are unfolding before them. I mean, you can see our government is a reactive government. It doesn't have wisdom. It's just reacting to crisis after crisis. What happened to all the old wise men that used to hang around governments and advise the president, you know, old men that were, you know, because there's no respect for the aged in our culture. See? Right. Now, what is that wisdom we're talking about? That wisdom is the higher consciousness that comes partly from experience, and that's why old men in some cultures are respected. It comes from the broader vision, the more cosmic understanding, right? Now, what do you want to do for your fellow man? Do you want to just get embroiled in the game at the level at which it's being played, and all you do is trade punch for punch? See, that, when you look at, like, you take a people that are active in the liberal movement, like the McCarthy people and so on. I stood in front of the Boston Hilton Hotel watching a parade, a protest against Hubert Humphrey with placards and things like that. And I watched the police arrive, and I watched the thing develop, and all I saw were two sides equally attached to their game, equally creating the need for the other. There was no doubt about it at all. And you say, is that conscious behavior? That isn't conscious as far as I can see. And that's just perpetuating. It may look good because it's in a pretty colored clothing. And it may say words like peace. I want peace. The way you express peace is by being a peaceful human being. No matter how much bloodshed there is, you create no more peace by protesting against the bloodshed. Even if you have to go to Vietnam and die doing it, that's the point. That's the point.
You know,
you can only teach by being. That's all you can be.
Isn't whatever he does okay, provided he goes to Benares and dies there? You know, because you automatically get off, or don't you believe that? How much authority does that have?
Well, I'll tell you, it isn't quite works. Doesn't quite work that way. I guess it's a little unfair to say whatever you've done. It is true whatever you've done, but you. I don't know.
Because what you said before seemed to imply that, you know, previous karma, not was.
That is true. That's true. At the moment of death, no matter how much of a sinner you've been, that's true. Exactly. I have to say that's true. Doesn't matter what he does. If he goes to Benares and dies. And if he doesn't go to Benares and dies, it just means he'll go on and on living out his karma.
But how much authority does that have, the notion of dying in Benares? Where does that get its authority?
Well, authority in India is an interesting issue because most of the stuff comes from the Vedas and from the holy books of India, which are written by realized beings. And therefore, it's people who see and therefore know, right?
And they say this.
And they say this, yes.
Another thing, earlier you mentioned, you said you'd say more later about Meher Baba.
Yeah. Well, I would like to just finish this run through the Ashtanga Yoga. I don't feel that I have completely resolved this issue with you.
Well, the issue I think is this, simply, that in the East, most of the Easterns, although this is a gross simplification I know, feel that they can, if they wait long enough, they'll be able to starve evil, and I hate that word, out. And that they don't have to play, say, you don't have to play these people's game on their level, as you put it, which was a good way of putting it. But, and once I would have agreed with you, but now I'm not so sure, because for instance, in the student riots at Columbia, the students have gotten what they want, and it seems they only get what they want these days through violence. I mean, the system has become
so
insensitive.
It's very interesting of what they got. See, you know, it really is interesting what they got, what the Negroes are getting. Because what you can't measure it that quickly. You can't measure it that quickly.
Well, I'm assuming what I'm reading.
Well, no, you can read it all, and you can say they got all of the rights they wanted at Columbia.
No, not all. They got
well,
all
right.
But they got something.
Yeah, but what else happened along the way? I mean, is for example, is there an inevitable civil war appearing in the United States because everybody is getting what they want by the means they know how, which is violence?
But if no other way works, what then?
Well, you see, the business of works is the question, and works involves that is the Western method of measuring in terms of the external criteria. And you have got to understand that unless we end up with more peaceful human beings inside, then all of the peace efforts, unless we end up with more liberal human beings inside, all the liberalness efforts, unless we end up with more contentment inside, all of the ideas for economic liberation are meaningless. They're absolutely meaningless. And all you see is that the nature of the human beings in the West is getting what you would call, from most vantage points, more and more ugly. More and more ugly. So that who's getting what? You know, it's like you win the battle and lose the war, you see. And you dig, you don't know where to get in to do it until you understand that each man's job is to work on himself. Because until you're a pure vehicle for truth and for consciousness, anything you do may be doing just the opposite of what you thought it was doing, which is the good case with the whole business of violence in a lot of the movements, because they are creating the conditions of violence. When I first met the guru, I couldn't see him often enough. And now I think because that place where I can go inside of myself is the place where he is, where that of him, which I really know is, I don't really ever care whether I see him again in the flesh. It would be nice, and I'll love it, but it doesn't matter. I mean, it's not an attachment in that sense. The blanket, sure, I've got a lot of things that are what trivial attachments. You know as well as I do that I love the blanket because I'm having a hard struggle being in the West, because I forget so often, and little things like that help remind me. To that extent, I am attached to the things that help me on my journey, knowing that ultimately, before I finish my journey, I must give up all these things. I've got to give up the attachment to them. In other words, I'm not ready to give you this blanket, my security blanket. And yet, I understand what you're saying. And most of the people, there's a very interesting expression in India. See, there are three gunas in nature. There is tamas, rajas, and sattvic. And tamas is ignorance and darkness and all kinds of dark and horrible things. And rajas is action. And sattvic is purity. And when you have done a lot of work in many incarnations, you free yourself, you purify, and you get further and further freer so that you're more and more sattvic, and you become a very sattvic person, a very pure person. You have met many in the West. They're good people. We call them good people. You know, they do good things. They're a good person. They're good in their human relations and all. And the expression in India is that for most people, they are bound to the world by an iron chain. A sattvic person is bound to the world by a golden chain. It's golden, but it's still a chain. And this is part of the problem of the thing we're talking about, too. That the attachment to good and evil is still an attachment. And surrounding a guru are always many people who are very good people, you know, that hang out around temples, you know. But they still have a long way to go, you know, probably many lifetimes to go, because they can't get, they're addicted to being good. It really is, and it's addiction. It's an addiction. But there's an awful lot of fraudulence in India. I mean, out of the 10 million sadhus, probably 3/4 of them are fake. At least, I'm being very Christian in my estimate. Whatever that means. Okay, let me finish a few of these little things I've been left hanging around. So the study, you read the books of realized people, and I was about to say, when you raised your hand, that realized that in the West, we tend to read, say you read a book by a guy who's read a book by a realized being. Or let's say you come to hear me, see, and I'm not a realized being, we all know that. But I'm on the journey. Well, that's a nice thing. That's like the golden chain. You know, I could be on the journey for the next 50 lives. Why aren't I just doing it? What am I doing talking to you? Why not, you know, that kind of thing. I'm doing it, but that's, how many levels can we work at once? It's only words. But maybe there is some very deep flaw in my strategy of doing my sadhana, which is so subtle that I am not conscious of it, and I can't get hold of it. I'm like Typhoid Mary, because what I'm really conveying to you is my own perception of how it is, and I'm selling you the whole thing, which is the reason why I'm not enlightened. You understand that? Therefore, every time you read a book by somebody who is telling you about enlightened people, see, that's why they say you can only read books by enlightened people, right? You can only read books by people who made it, because they're speaking from that other place, and then, if they bothered to write a book, see, and then the question is, well, why'd they write a book? And you go that whole, that's another thing. So you can read Ramana Maharshi, or usually they're the sayings of realized beings that have been written down. Ramana Maharshi, Ramakrishna, Buddha, Christ. And there are many such beings. Meher Baba is a realized being. Now, these writings are very, very helpful, extremely helpful, even if you just read a paragraph a day, because they definitely remind you of the perceptual point from inside looking out, from the place you're trying to get to. Very useful, extremely useful. Now there is one called tapas in Niyama, which means austerities, but you've got to remember it's got to be austerities which aren't austere. And that whole living in the temple, which when you come back and you tell Westerners, and I had a blanket and I slept on the floor and I washed in the river and I ate one meal, oh, they say, oh, and they, you poor thing, and oh, what suffering you've gone through. And inside it's just such a joke because it makes no difference. It makes no difference. There's no suffering. What's that about? It's just like living in the Hilton. It's no difference. And so it's got to be austerities that aren't austere. You've got to be, it's got to be a joyous adventure or the hell with it. I mean, just go another couple of hundred lives, you know. If it's going to be that miserable, you're too attached to the misery to get on with it, so why bother? This is not a masochist delight, you know, no matter how masochistic it sounds to somebody who labels the world as masochistic. Now there is one that's called surrender to God, and here I must digress for a moment to talk about bhakti yoga. In the West, we have gone through such a bad trip about religion, because religion has become a major social institution in our culture, pretty much devoid of spiritual content. That is, the power of the Spirit, that which Christ said, and the Spirit descended into them, is not very clearly in evidence in most of the leaders of Western religions at the moment. That's the most charitable way I can say what I have to say. Right? And you read the words of Christ and you realize there is a very high yogi speaking. I mean, there's a guy that really knew. And it's very funny because when this winter, when I read the Old Testament, the New Testament, you come across things like, and the Red Sea parted, and he withered the fig tree, and, you know, all those things. And had you by faith, you could move mountains. Now I'm living in a world in India where it was just sure, of course. And so suddenly the Bible, which used to be a nice allegory, you know, a good book to give me examples of that somebody made up to teach me something, it's true. I mean, yogis do those things, you see. Those powers are available to human beings. But in the West, the model that religion sells is all you can do is pray, and then if you're good at the end of life, when you die, you can go to a place called heaven. I'll tell you about heaven in a second. And if you're bad, you go to hell, which is the polar of that. And you can't do it during your lifetime. They don't sell that.
WBAI New York.
They don't sell enlightenment during life. And furthermore, it pretty well is agreed that nobody's been enlightened since the Bible. For example, you take the internal prayer of the heart, which we'll get to. I can do it right in Christianity, show you the issue. Let's compare Greek Orthodox Christianity and Western Christianity. Western Christianity has, I was with, 2 days ago, I was with a girl who has been a very high nun. She's a Mother Superior for some 10, 12 years. She's an old girlfriend of mine. She married a higher yogi. And I explored with her the attitude towards Christian mysticism, mystics. Of course, there were many, Teresa and so on, many. And they are reasonably well relegated to either the concerns of very monastic sects within Christianity. Or they are treated again as teaching examples. They are not presented as living examples of something a person aspires to in this life. All of this stuff is available, always has been in the West, you understand. This is nothing unique to the East. It's just that there is a different kind of zeitgeist or a different kind of acceptance. In the little village I was living in, everybody believes in miracles, right here and now. You find a village around here where everybody believes in miracles. I mean, when I went around saying, do you know what the guru did? He told me I ate biscuits in Delhi. Oh, of course, man, let me tell you the story that happened to me last week. Right? See, that's the difference, that you're living in a culture where they are ready to hear about this, and that gives you a lot of support for it happening, and for you not rejecting the thing happening inside yourself. Now, let me compare what happened, because the Greek Orthodox Church, which recognizes, for example, the writings of Christian fathers who were mystics, and recognizes them and builds them directly into the religion, uses a book called the Philokalia. In fact, many of you may have seen a book called Way of the Pilgrim, which is a delightful book describing a pilgrimage into the inner place using just the simple prayer, Lord Jesus Christ, Son of God, have mercy on me. Lord Jesus Christ, Son of God, have mercy on me. Lord Jesus Christ, Son of God, have mercy on me. Lord Jesus Christ, Son of God, have mercy on me. Now let me explain to you what this whole business is about of bhakti and mantra and saying a thing like that. The way it really works is you start out and you say it, and you're saying it with your mouth and your lips and words. And then as you keep saying it, after like a few days or a week or something like that, you start to hear it being said all the time inside yourself, and you don't have to keep repeating it with your lips. But that's still only part way home. And then finally, it starts to move and you start to feel it happening inside what you would call it your heart area. And this is not just suggestion. I must argue very strongly that Ramana Maharshi's things about the heart and all of the people who have located the source of consciousness is anahata, that chakra, are probably correct. Because that is the place where you end with this very powerful feeling, and it becomes, here's what you're doing. Now I'll talk as a psychologist for a second. You use bhakti yoga, or you use what's called dwait as opposed to advait, or dualism as opposed to monism. You use there's me, the servant, or he who prays, or the lover, and there is the beloved. You use that as a vehicle into the unitive state. At the point where you finish, where it works, you become one with the thing you worship or pray to. In other words, it's a device. It's another device. These are all what in psychology are called heuristics. They are devices for changing your cognitive map, for changing the things you think about, for changing the types of association patterns that your mind has that you are working with every day. Now, I'll give you an example. When I sit down to eat, I cannot eat food that has not been consecrated. Now, what does that mean? It could mean something like, oh man, do we have to sit through grace again? Right, that thing, you know, like, quick grace, pass, okay, grace, pass the turkey, you know, that kind of thing. That's what happened to it in the West, right? Now, I sit down and I say the following. I say, Brahmarpanam, Brahmahavir, Brahmagni, Brahmanahota, Brahmaitan Gantabhyam, Brahma Karma Samadhina. What that has said in translation is the ritual of doing this consecration is Brahma. That is, it is that which all of this returns to. The offering, the food, is Brahma. He who offers it, that means this, is Brahma. The fire, meaning the hunger, to which it is offered is Brahma. He who realizes that all is Brahma returns to Brahma, in other words, realizes enlightenment. Now what you're doing is you're taking that old rice that's sitting there, and instead of I am eating rice, you have taken that act and used it as another device to get out of the attachment to me eating, because it's all the same thing. You see it as all, you've just taken your mind and taken it out to the other place, which then allows you to do the thing which finally I had to do to get off the food trip attachment, which is I had to be able to remain in the place of the witness, or what the Gurdjieffians call the point of self-remembering, the place from which one remembers, and observe eating. I am now eating. Observe. There's a book by Rodney Collin called Theory of Celestial Influence. Extremely good book. And he is a Gurdjieffian, was a student of Uspensky. And he says, what is required at this stage is three components. There's you and there's the food, or there's you and there's the book, or there's you and there's the chick, or there's you and there's the money, or you and the power, or whatever it is. There's those things. And if there's only those two things, you'll get caught in fascination. Like, oh, wow, the book. And you try to remember, but you can't quite do it because you keep forgetting and getting lost in fascination with the food, or fascination with the book, or fascination with sex. What you need is a third party. That third party can be Om, it can be God, it can be Uncle Henry, it can be Brahma, it can be anything you want to call it, but it can be the witness. It has to be the quality that it does nothing but is there. It's just a third being. It doesn't evaluate, it doesn't do anything. And what you have to do is keep that present all the time, whatever you're doing. This is the first step. This is the step that the Gurdjieffians are working on, almost all of them. Because self-remembering means you bring in that part of you, which is this third person, like the sun, which is just observing it all happening. So, there I am eating, says the third person. Right? So when you pray to Brahma, you are merely invoking that third consciousness to keep you from getting trapped by the desire. Now, the problem I had, which you will appreciate, was that I didn't want to give up the pleasure of the food in order to go to that other place, because in order to do that, it takes all the joy out of eating. And I didn't want to give up that joy, because joy has to go. That's hard, see, because what you get substitute for it is bliss. It's very tricky. But sometimes a bird in the hand and two in the bush, you know, like there's the food, and man, I can get a lot of joy out of just See, I can't do it yet. I mean, I'm just not ready to do it. I can't handle it. I mean, what happens is the desire just gets so strong, I just get lost. And I see that, and I realize it. And the teacher said, you know, you're probably not ready to do it. You're going to get a tremendous... He said, just what happened? He says, you're going to get a tremendous desire to use Tantra when you get to the West. Right? Sure, because every chick that comes along, she's already used Tantra. Right? And boy, and you think, well, if I can take this energy, which is so powerful, the sexual energy, and take it and work through that thing to go beyond it, I'll use that huge booster pump to go, you know, to the higher point. But the trap is too powerful. And it's too hard to realize to keep... See, the thing is, in Tantra, in Tibet, for example, the Dakinis, the temple goddesses who are involved in Tantra, are trained from childhood to be spiritual beings and not to get involved in the carnal trip. And therefore, the guy is the lama, the young lama, you know, he's trying to remember and he's trying to remember, and suddenly there's this beautiful chick and he's just about to, and she intones a mantra or something like that, you know. See, because she is she's trained almost like a robot to remain at that other place before she can be a temple goddess. But in the West, you know, if one person could keep cool, it would make it, but I can't, and I certainly can't find anybody else who can. You see? And therefore, it only takes one person to do it, you see. If one person can keep from getting involved, then you can do it, but because the other person, it takes two to do a dance of any kind, and you just can't, you can't get attached in sex unless the other person will go along with you. But the thing is that we are so subtle in our seductions into our desires that as fast as you finish with one, the ego comes up with a new creative, you know, just as you think you've finished with something, boy, the sadhana, I should end, I know you may be tired, sadhana is very much like a roller coaster. Any of you that are involved, and I'm sure most of you in some way or other are involved in your spiritual journey, just being here, thinking about these issues, reading about them, trying, reflecting, you're all doing this work. And the journey is, you make a breakthrough and you get into a new state of understanding and comprehension, and then the next day, just as if like the door is closed and you feel like you've lost and you're defeated and you feel lust and anger and all these horrible things. I mean, I would be in the ashram and I get to a very high state and then I dream that I'm making love to a girl and in a very sexual, lustful way, and then I hear cats screaming in the next room and I go in and I take one of the cats and I beat it to death with a shoe. And then a bell rings and I wake up and it's the temple bell. And I think, holy God, how can a guy who dreams like that, you know, and it takes me through a whole depression and I've got to go, you know, confront all of that, who is that and what's all that about? But Ramana Maharshi says one of the most beautiful, beautiful things, which will help all of you, I think, in the West, because it's an illness we all have. I can recite it, but I'd rather read it, because I think it's... He says, however sinful a person may be, if he would stop wailing inconsolably, alas, I am a sinner, how shall I attain liberation? And casting away even the thought that he is a sinner, if he would zealously carry on his work on realizing the self, he would most assuredly get reformed. And that is the answer to the whole trip of psychotherapy, if you start to think about it. Because psychotherapy is the idea that you get off a hang-up by dealing with it enough till you've reorganized your perception about it. The other trip, the alternative, is to divest the energy. Sure, you're hung up. We're all hung up, man. Now, spend your time building this other house you're going to live in inside yourself. And as you live in this other house more and more, these other things fall away. They cease to be. They fall away like a skin from a snake. So if you've got a sexual hang-up, instead of, well, I've got to solve this sexual hang-up before I can get on with it, just go and do your work, your sadhana, and then pretty soon the sexual problem ceases to be that significant to you. Now, that's very hard to do, but it is a... I found, and I had to give up a lot of, because I'm the kind that, you know, goes back into childhood experiences and all that stuff in myself to understand. And I would sit and give the most excruciatingly brilliant analyses of my problems. And the teacher would look at me with infinite compassion, you know. That was all he could muster. Now the question is, what is this house you go and live in? The way I can tell you about the house now, I'm going to do it two ways. I'm going to show you two meditation exercises which take you to the house. One of them is so extremely brilliant, Ramana Maharshi's Vichara Atma, Who Am I? Because it's just so powerful. It takes a little while to get onto, but it works. You go through the following sequence. You say, who am I? And you say, I am not this gross body. Now what you do then is you take the statement I. You can start saying I, and I will slowly get located in the middle of your head if you would like it to be. And then, now you're doing this in a purely mechanical way with your thought process. Now experience your body, feel your body, and the eye is in the middle of the head, and then separate that eye from the body. Mechanical. Now it'll be clearer with another example. I am not the five senses. Now, if you are reading a book and a clock is ticking, when you get involved in the book, you cease to hear the clock tick. You've all had that experience. Then you finish the book and there's the clock ticking, and it was ticking all the time, although you had ceased to notice it. It was ticking, the ticking was being received by your ear, but your attention was elsewhere, directed elsewhere, so there was a break in the mechanism at an inner point. Well, now that's exactly the point you've got to learn to voluntarily control. So what you do is you watch your senses doing their thing. For example, eye is in the middle of the head, and now you separate, watch your eyes seeing. In other words, you can see me, I am a stimulus, and then your optic nerve is receiving this. And you can, if you sit with the eye in the middle of your head, you're doing it mechanically now, and it's not feeling quite right, but you can work with it. You can see your eye seeing me. I mean, you can separate it from the eye. You can separate this eye. I am awareness. There's three things: awareness, the eye, and the object. And there's the object and the eye and then the awareness. And you're just rooting yourself in that awareness, which you're calling I, and you're separating things from it. So hearing, tasting, feeling, so on. Then you go through, the way Ramana Maharshi takes you through is, I am not the five organs of action, the arms, the legs, the tongue, the anal sphincter, and the genitals. And then I am not the five internal organs, and the respiration and secretion and circulation and so on. And in each case, You either feel or visualize the thing and keep that eye in the middle of your head. Now, the final one he does is the clincher. This is the why I told the whole story. Final one is, I am not this thought. See, you've gotten rid of your body, you've gotten rid of your senses, you've gotten rid of the internal organs. Your eye is separate from all that. But I is still the thought, I. Now you say, I am not the thought. I am not my thought. Now what you're really saying is, I am not the thought of I. The statement, I am not the thought of I, is a thought. You understand? So what you do, if you know on the Times building, the way the news passes on the ticker thing, well, I am not the thought of I starts to be out there when you work with this. And then the place where you just left, which now is unlabelable, of course, because any label is merely another thing out there, right? Well, that's the place you're going to. Now, if you work with this little game for a while, very simple, you start to slowly get better and better at separating and separating and separating, and finally, you've got to go behind the I thought. As Ramana Maharshi said, the I thought is the stick with which the funeral pyre is stirred and it finally gets burned itself. It's the last thing to get burned. So that's one way of defining where that place is inside. I mean, how do you go there, right? Now, here's another way of thinking about this. I'll give you a theoretical model now. Think of concentric circles now. The outer circle is called the indriyas, meaning the senses. The next circle is called manas, or the will or desire. Then an inner circle is called buddhi, which is rational thought. And then inside of that is a place, a core, an inner circle, which is called the atman. Now, the task is to first turn off the senses. You're pulling in slowly and slowly and slowly into this inner place. When I took psilocybin the first time and I said all that was left was a point of awareness, I saw it as a little teeny point. Little did I know, because I had not yet gone through that door, what that point was, because the point, or the bindi, the point was the all. And this is the thing that this is what pushes Westerners over the edge in terms of their understanding. And I'll tell you why, because it is, maybe you can only understand this theoretically at this point. Through that door lies what in India is called Sat Chit Ananda. And Sat Chit Ananda is total existence, total understanding or knowledge or wisdom, and total bliss. Meaning that everything in the universe is created, exists in that place. Now, I've got to explain what that place is from another level. I'm just going to keep laying like baklava, layer upon layer of telling you what the place is. If you think in terms of usual thought process, you are thinking probably in a cellular process. That's the way cells work. Speed of cells, association of neurons is probably at the cellular level. When you move a little faster and work in what's called the astral plane, you move to what's often like molecular speed, which means like perfumes and things like that. They permeate space. When you finally get to this place, your consciousness, when it gets free of your thought process, free of your thought process now, functions very much like light. That means like electricity or electrons. In other words, it functions at the speed of light. It is instantaneous for all intents and purposes. That is exactly how that guru can be in time and space wherever he needs to be, and be at more than one place at the same time with his consciousness, because it functions in that way. It functions at a different speed, and it, now, in order to, oh, this is so much I'm trying to tell you all at once. Take Ramana Maharshi. Here's a guy who at 17 years old, right, is sitting in his uncle's living room. He's a high school student. He's not a spiritual guy. He's not doing a thing on his sadhana. He's just going to school, right? And he gets a tremendous presentiment that he's going to die. And he lies down, instead of calling for help, he lies down, he stretches out his body, and he thinks of himself as having died. He does this for some reason he doesn't know. And he sees his body being carried to the burning ghat and burned and so on. And he notices that though it is burned, he still remains pure, fully conscious. Right? And he has this experience. Now, that's the experience, if you understand, that I had with my first psilocybin session. The only trouble was 2 days later I was back as Richard Alpert. Ramana Maharshi never came back. He, from there, left home 2 weeks later. He dropped out, right? He went to Arunachala, one of the holiest mountains in near Madras. He went up on the hill and he sat there, and for 50 years he was a saint who was there for everybody. Now, here is a guy who went to high school, dropped out at 17, and pundits in science, in philosophy, in law would come to him and they would ask him the meaning of highly esoteric points. And he knew it all. He knew it all. And the thing that the Westerner can't handle, because we are so used to learning from outside in, learning through symbols, through our senses, is to realize that anything you could ever learn that way, you already know. All you have to do is be free of the attachments in order to be part of it all. It's the difference between subject-object learning and purely subjective experience. Your arm is part of you, and therefore the learning goes on. You know it. It's like an internal process. Well, when you have merged with the universe, then the universe is your arm. It's all part of you, and you know it all. And it's not like, oh, wow, is that the way it is? It's more like, sure, that's the way it is, right? Everything from then on is merely confirmation. It can't be new. There's nothing new. Nothing is new from that place because it's all old. It's all there already. Now, if I take, for example, I'll give you a meditation that works, that's a very simple one. This is from the Theravadin Buddhists.
WBAI New York.
Which I use a lot. It's very simple and very, very good. It's called Satipatthana Vipassana. I'll only give you the rudimentary first step of it. You don't go anywhere. Who's that who hates to go? And there are many, many Southern Buddhists, and this is the only thing they do for their enlightenment, and it works very beautifully, very powerful technique. They concentrate on their abdomen, which every time it goes up, every time you breathe in, it goes up, and every time you breathe out, it goes down. And what they then say is, rising, falling. Rising, falling. Now, if you were doing that rising and falling, and those voices outside you heard, you're not doing the thing. Okay? All right? Here's an example. All right? Now, what you do then under those conditions is you say, you're rising, falling, you hear the voices, you say, listening. In other words, you label the thing that caught you as soon as you wake up to the fact that you've been caught. It takes you, at first it takes you a long time to wake up, then the latency gets shorter and shorter and shorter, and you're waking up sooner and sooner and sooner until you're practically waking up the minute you go to sleep. And then you go back to rising and falling and rising and falling. Now, you're doing it inside. You're not saying rising and falling, rising and falling. Now, I found that I was a Western achiever, so I couldn't quite just sit and say rising and falling. Well, now, that is the devices which what I called in the in Ashtanga Yoga Pratyahara Dharana and Dhyana are roughly for the same purpose. That is, the way it's described beautifully in the Tibetan writings of the Tilopa about Mahamudra. Says, at first a yogi feels his mind is tumbling like a waterfall. In mid-course, like the Ganga, it flows on slow and gentle. In the end, it is a great vast ocean where the lights of sun and mother merge in one. And this is the experience you have. At first, you rising, falling, and then your mind is here, and then your mind is there, and then it's there, and then it's there. Or, who am I, who am I, who am I? I am not the thought of I, and then you're there, and then suddenly there's a thought that's carried you away. And the minute you get the thought, who am I, and you go right back into the thing again. Whichever method you use, at first, you're amazed when you observe it. And those of you that have done the Gurdjieff method know this, how the mind is just like, they liken it, Vivekananda likens it to a monkey who is agitated to begin with, has just been bitten by a scorpion, and who's drunk. And that's really what the mind is like. It's just absurd how out of control our minds are. And in the West, with all of our technology and all of our sophistication, there's no discipline at all of the mind to calm it, to make it one-pointed, and all of the power that comes from being able to direct our consciousness, to be able to go into something, so that I can get into this book, get out of me looking at the book and into the bookness. Then I can understand the bookness, and that's what the siddhis or powers are that come along with concentration, being able to read others' minds and can change nature and all that. It's the power that comes from one-pointedness of mind plus this control and direction of energy. Now, close your eyes and I will give you two... this is a poem by Ram Tirth, who was an enlightened being who walked into the Ganga at 24 and just kept walking. The Ganga being the consciousness of God is brought down through Krishna. I am without form. Without limit. I am beyond space. Beyond time. I am in everything. Everything is in me. I am the bliss of the universe. Everywhere I am. I am existence, absolute, knowledge, absolute, bliss, absolute. I am that. I am that. And his second brief poem is, quotation, I have no scruple of change, nor fear of death, I was never born, nor had I parents. I have no scruple of change, nor fear of death. I was never born, nor had I parents. Now that is written by a realized being who is sitting in the middle of that place. Without form, without limit, beyond space, beyond time. The one thing that most Westerners lack, that holds them back, is faith in the existence of this place. What we call the cynicism of the Western world prevents us from having that kind of faith, which is a prerequisite for going through the door where you must go beyond faith. And that is what bhakti yoga is about. Bhakti yoga is a way through using your emotions to generate the love and the desire and the feeling and the hope and the belief, which creates the ground in which the flower can finally grow. And when the flower blooms, it goes beyond all of that. Now, Ram Tirth, who said that, did what was a representative of what's called Gyan Yoga, which is what the Vedantists are involved in. And Gyan Yoga says they are monists. They are saying, I am it, which we are. But their method is, we're just talking about differences in method, their method is to just reiterate, I am it, I am it, I am it, I am it, and any time you bring up anything else, forget it, baby, I am it. And that's the whole Zen trip also. The opposite of that is the bhakti of starting from where you are in that outside being and then slowly working to become the one with it. Right? Now, for example, I, who am a reasonably sophisticated Westerner, sit many hours before a picture of a Murti, that is a consecrated statue, of a monkey called Hanuman. Right? Now, my father comes along and says, what are you, worshiping a monkey? Right? Hanuman, in the story in the Ramayana, Ram, who is an incarnation of God and a very pure being like Christ in many ways, has difficulties and with people who are having bad karma. And as a result of this, Hanuman comes to his aid. And Hanuman wants only to serve Ram. Hanuman's whole desire in life is to serve Ram. Okay. Now, what you have to understand about this is that Hanuman gains all of his power in his, if you want to call it, mythological role or whatever role you want to call it, through this worship of God. And the way it works is this. When you do the worship, you open your, he is the perfect servant, right? He is in the role of servant. Das is my name, servant, right? I am part of a Hanuman follower group, right? Because the perfect servant is not the person who never complains about their work but inwardly feels any anger or works for money or anything. They serve because they serve out of a unitive desire, a desire to be one with the master. Now, the way it works is that when you open yourself up to a representative of that inner room that we've been talking about, which can be your guru, or it can be Ram, or it can be Christ, or it can be the Lord, or it can be anything. When you open up and open your heart that way to them, to that representative, you start to experience all of the power, if you will, or all of the energy transformation. And that's why in the story, Hanuman is characterized as being, quote, the breath of Ram. That is, the relation between servant and master. And Ram says, when I am separate from you, when Ram asks him, he says, when I am separate from you, I merely think of you as my master who I serve with all of the love at my command. And then when I am one with you, I go beyond that. We are the same. Now, you have to understand the exquisiteness of the Ram model. That by the concept of surrender, of giving over the Western idea of it's my ego, it's my life, it's my trip, I've got to rule my roost, I've got to design my own game. Who wants to be a servant? Man, the maid problem, you can't get served. Who wants to be a servant anymore? It's such a low status thing. And when there's a movie called The Servant, it's all about a Machiavellian type servant who's trying to, a power struggle. Because the concept, the purest concept of serving out of love is one we've lost a little, we've lost in the West. Now, the beauty of this is, you've got to understand that my guru is constantly serving.
Now, I'll just take you one little side thing by telling you that in the sects that follow Krishna, there are a sect called the Shakt sect, who are gopis. You know in the story of Krishna and the gopis are the milkmaids of Vrindavan, and they dance on moonlit nights. Krishna dances with them. Krishna is the incarnation of God who dances, and he makes love with 16,000 of them just in the way each of them wants to be made love to, right? Because in the bhakti relationship in the West, we have John's relation to Christ, that's sort of like a brother. Then we have Mary's relation to Christ, that's as a mother. You have different models of how you can worship the Lord. Brother, mother, father, son. Well, the highest one of the 12 that are possible is that of lover to beloved. We don't have that because Jehovah doesn't have anybody like Hotfer's body, and you know, Christ doesn't, it doesn't work. It's, you know, the Westerners can't handle putting those two things together. But in India, Krishna is dancing and cavorting, and the powder from the breasts of the maidens is rubbing off on Krishna, and they're just dancing in an orgy of ecstasy. Now, the exquisite point you get to with bhakti yoga is that the more you open your heart, the closer you get to being one with that which you love and which you serve and which you are in tune with. Then, as you do it more and more, you finally go through the door into the place where you are one with that, you're in that room. And then, the way bhaktis do it, is they come back just far enough to worship and go back out again. In other words, they come back into the lower state of bliss for the love they're experiencing as a leverage to take them back into that place. And they're just revolving right in at that fine line between going in and out of, I come back to serve, and then I merge, and then I come back to serve. That's the way they stay in their bodies. See, they come back to this very fine. Now, in many Eastern places, like in Japan, it is thought Zen gives you the feeling there is a moment of enlightenment. Well, we can liken that to the drug experience of the moment at which you see the possibility. That is the moment of enlightenment, because from then on it's irreversible. You know that there's this room, you know there's this place inside of human beings, and you want to go there. So you start to select and move in that direction, or you may have read about it, or had a mystical experience in your childhood, or at the moment of childbirth experienced it. I mean, there are dozens of ways people have had this experience. That's the moment of enlightenment. From then on, as my teacher said, the layers of ego get thinner and thinner and thinner like clouds until all you keep is a transparent layer just enough to keep you in the body, for the body to do its work. And you, through all of this thinning, you can continue to be the same guy in the outside world or woman doing the same karma yoga, but constantly you are pulling away, you are thinning that layer, and it's a continuous process. And if you look at your own lives, you will see you can trace the onset of virag, the onset of freeing from attachment. You can trace the onset of the meaning of various kinds of feelings inside. You can watch, because this is like, these lines are like this, the way they work. They're not like that. And it's a mistake to sit and say, am I going to be enlightened or aren't I going to be enlightened? You all wouldn't be here, literally, in this room if you did not know of that possibility. And that, as far as you need be concerned, is all that you need to worry about, that thing happening. From now on, it's merely the process of thinning the cloud, and that's a very, literally, a mechanical operation. And if I can, I don't know what my role is and why I was sent back to the United States for a year, but One of the things I see is that I'm trained as a social scientist, and one of the things that should be possible is to translate for the Western mind the process, this process of the transformation, of the opening up, of the change from cynicism to hope, and do it in a way that a Western consciousness can understand and see it as a day-by-day process that they can do along with their karma yoga. And talk about it as cognitive reorganization, and talk about it in the terms, get it away from, because the way we're doing it now, see, you come because I went to India. And like, what do those Indians know, right? Well, and I come back and I got this whole trip on Baba Ram Das and all that. Well, you know who I am. I mean, here I am. I don't know who I am. It's, you know, it's, I'm halfway between being, right, and that place. As often as I can remember, I go to that place. Now, what I'm suggesting to you is that when you can get free of religion and the idea that prayer is a hustle, you can see that it's a very sophisticated type of yoga for opening your emotions to the point where you can merge. It's like the highest love relationship. It's the highest love relationship. It's falling in love with that inner room is really what it's doing. In a particular form, you pick. You want to pick a 16-year-old image, pick Padmasambhava, or Guru Rinpoche from Tibet, and put them in your heart. You want Buddha? You want Christ? You want Om? You want the sun, Surya? Aditya Hridayam Punyam Sab Shatru Bina Shanam. Just keep saying that every time you see the sun. All evil vanishes from life to he who keeps the sun in his heart. The sun is light, it's consciousness, pure consciousness. Just bring the sun in and keep it there all the time. What I'm saying to you is, I am undertaking a task. I see it as a task. It's not a big mystical thing. Now, the guru was great, because what the guru did, I now see, was he was a perfect mirror, which is what a guru is. Since he isn't there at all, there isn't any guy there. There's just a body, but there is full consciousness. He was mirroring my desires and my needs, and because of my Western cynicism, he gave me that, quote, miracle in order to cut through my mind. Because that's what I needed, was a miracle. I desired a miracle to move the next step. A miracle where I wasn't under drugs. And he gave it to me. And what he did in hundreds of other cases is he was just a perfect mirror of where I was at and where everybody around him is at. And once you realize that, and you realize that that guru is in my heart, and the minute you understand that, then he's there for you, too. You see, it has nothing to do with my personality. It's not me. See? So the whole model of I got to go find a guru is only because you want somebody to flip you from cynicism to hope. Because hope is the only ingredient you need to do all of the rest of the stuff which you know how to do and which you can figure out and find in books to do. But without the hope, none of it works. Because you can't cynically say, well, I'll try it. Can't do it that way. See? I think that it is not appropriate. It is kind of a cop-out to say, I can't do anything because I don't have a teacher or a guru. I think you can continue to do the work on oneself, and when you get to a certain point, when you are ready, that person will be there. It may not be in any form that you could estimate. There are what's called upagurus and satguru. Upagurus are all the people along the way that were more conscious than you at some moment that showed you something, right? And they are your teachers all along the way. They've been there for years. You've had hundreds of them, and you'll have hundreds more. And as you get to each new level, there'll be another one there. Now, it is true that it is very ideal if you can have your own private, fully conscious being hanging with you all the time, which is what a guru is, right? But once you have started the process, then the guru is inside, then you don't need him anymore. And the question is whether or not the psychedelic experience for many people hasn't taken them over that hurdle, which is what Gurdjieff and Uspensky are talking about when they talk about the need for a teacher. You see, because when you start just from mind, from thought, you can't get beyond thought because you haven't experienced the possibility. You understand? So your mind will take you into too many traps. But once you have had an experience which you have inside, which is a validating criterion against which you measure, then it's as if you already have that thing inside. As I say, it's much easier if you have a guru or teacher. But it's not an either-or proposition unless you just happen to read in a book or read an announcement that this lecture is being given and you don't know why you're here except, you know, you're interested in the economic problems of India. Because then maybe you didn't hear what was being said today. See, I mean, that's the only possibility in which somebody here would feel they can't do anything because they don't have a teacher. Or, you know, you'd say to them, you can't go ahead without a teacher. I mean, there are people I talk to, like my father's friends, right? They come up and they see me hanging around with a dress and a beard and, you know, like, well, how interesting, you've been in India, tell us all about it. Well, they don't know what they're asking, so I tell them. And they're fascinated. They're absolutely fascinated. That's just the word, fascinated, in the Rodney Collin thing. I mean, they get lost in it. It's so wonderful. They sleepwalk right through it, you know? It's as fascinating as the television show that they saw last week, which was fascinating. And it goes through them the same way. And there's a thing in the Gita that says, don't try to teach those that aren't ready to hear. But the fact of the matter is, you can't teach those that aren't ready to hear because they don't hear whatever it is you say anyway. Now, for those people, they need a teacher. See, when one of them would say, well, gee, this is interesting, how do I begin? I'd say, well, all right, here are some breathing exercises. Do these for a while. I can take you a first few steps of the way, and then if you do all that for a couple of years, then I'll turn you over to somebody who knows. Because each of us, see, when I was with Tim, we used to try to set up these communities following the Gurdjieff model that in order to escape from prison, you can't escape alone. Somebody's got to dig the tunnel, somebody's got to watch for the guards, and you know, the metaphor that he gives in the Search of the Miraculous. Then I realized, now as I look back, that everybody in those houses was asleep most of the time. You see, and therefore, we weren't really, nobody had the leverage to help the other people because all those models were based on one conscious being, you know. Usually Gurdjieff, because what happened after Gurdjieff died was that, you know, it was very hard on the whole system because his students were not Gurdjieff, that was all. They just hadn't shared the same experience. You know, and you watch the effect, the Gurdjieff system is an exquisitely beautiful system, and Gurdjieff was such a high conscious being. But you look two generations later in the students of the students of Gurdjieff, and you see what a struggle it is for them. Because they can't override their intellect. And the trouble with the method is it doesn't force you beyond your intellect hard enough. It's not destructive enough to the one thing that Westerners are so addicted to, which is the use of the mind. You know? It's too easy to do the Gurdjieff system from intellectual thing. It's a cop-out, and anybody that understands Gurdjieff knows that. But you cannot understand Gurdjieff and still do Gurdjieff for years and years and years. You know, that's one of the sad things. Like, one of the things I do every day is pranayama, is breathing. Now, when I do pranayama, that in no uncertain terms takes me beyond any conceptual framework that I have every single morning, right? Sometimes I would rather not do it because I don't want to give up my little world, but it's just like taking acid, just like taking acid. because, I mean, when I start to do pranayama in the morning, it literally just, it puts me into another state, and I come back, and I have to go back into forms again. I mean, I have to start all over again creating the universe. Now, that's what I mean by a method that has within it the seeds of its own destruction, you see. The only problem with pranayama is you come back and you haven't really finished off the thought processes that bring you down. You see, if you look at why you come down because your body catches you or your habits of thought catch you. All right, with pranayama and fasting and all that stuff, you get your body so it doesn't catch you so much. You open your spinal column so that the nerves can move freely, the nervous energy and so on. The sushumna. But that doesn't do much about your mind. And then you do these meditations, and they slowly calm your mind down until it becomes one-pointed. Then, only then, can you start to get into these states where you don't come back. And then, that is only the beginning, because that's only like the first room, and you got to go through room after room before you get into this internal place that Ram Tirth is describing. Yeah.
Sort of a circle of ideas. The first one is, why are you not with Mayor Baba? And the second one, it seems you have a here and a there, like you compare the peak of the drug experience also to the peak of, you say,
yeah,
that's it, like as opposed to Baba, who will say, you know, it's the subtle body and the gross spirit or whatever, that it seems that believe there's a hierarchy, which this is just an inkling of, although something beyond your normal consciousness.
That's what I was just saying, that there are different levels of samadhi. There are something
yeah,
like eight levels of samadhi, and
but you said like you've seen